Heads up.
My fellow Americans, as you've most likely heard in an off-the-record portion of an interview with ABC, I called Kanye West a jackass. And I gotta tell you, it felt pretty good, because he is. But since we're being honest, I would like to say that Congressman Joe Wilson is a racist son of a... as is that worthless piece of... Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck. Well, that is clearly out of his mother mind. Don't get me started on the Blue Dogs, those motherfucking I mean, Max Baucus and Ben Nelson should take their co-ops and their triggers and shove them so far up their asses that they never see the motherfucking light of a motherfucking day again. Thank you, and God bless the United States of America.
All right. Mm-hmm. And finally, the Patriot Act.
Well, this week, the Obama administration, Barack Obama, said that he supports extending three key provisions of the Patriot Act that are going to expire at the end of the year. Three provisions include one that supposedly has never been used. It's called the Lone Wolf provision, which allows the government to conduct surveillance on suspects with no known link to foreign governments or terrorist groups. In other words, literally anyone they want to conduct surveillance on, they can.
But, yeah, I think the chances that they've never used that are slim and none.
Yeah, I think that's proof that they've used it. They just don't want to tell us.
Yeah, and it really does underscore, as Maria says, how you know, Democrats criticized these provisions when they were Republican provisions. But now that they're in power, they're just fine with having all of these unprecedented powers that are really clear violations of the intent of the Constitution.
Poor people gonna rise up, take what's there. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talk about a revolution.
From the mobile fortress of Glee Glee Studios, you're about to hear This Week in Radical History for the week starting September 21st. Inspiration for this little ditty comes from the Slingshot Calendar Organizer, and more radical historical info came from the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website. And happy birthday, Daily Bleed.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes.
This week in radical history for September 21st, only got three items. 1638, New World. In a final act of the Pequoy War, English officials and their Native American allies in Connecticut divide the surviving 72 Pequoys and enslave them. The Puritans had lived under an uneasy truce with the Pequoy, but they wanted them out of the way so they could take their land. Using the murder of a white trader and Indian kidnapper as an excuse, the English attacked the Indians on Block Island 2 years ago. Realizing the battle with tribal warriors was only one way to destroy their will, the colonists had turned to a terrorist strategy of massacring non-combatants. Before today's slave deal, the war concluded with the English attack on the Mystic River village, where troops led by Captain John Marston killed at least 600 Pequoy. Never wanting to be outdone by the Americans, in 1989, Israeli soldiers began a 40-day occupation and house-to-house destruction of the Palestinian town of Beit Sharrum in retaliation for its mass 2 years refusal to pay taxes to the occupying Israeli government. To this day, Israel is still in violation of more UN resolutions than any other country in the world. September 21st, 11 years ago, the Daily Bleed website came online. The Daily Bleed website. Awesome work, and thank you, Daily Bleed. This week in radical history for September 22nd, 1692, the New World. Someday, in hopes of putting to rest the idea that the United States was founded on religious freedom, the last eight women hung for witchcraft in America colonies happened. However, not only witches, but also Quakers and non-Puritan Christians were persecuted in the colonies. Also on September 22nd, 1861, in an unprovoked peacetime attack, Army soldiers massacre a band of visiting Navajo men, women, and children during a horse race at Fort Wayne, New Mexico. Mighty Christian of them. Also on September 22, 1862, President Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, and the Union starts to recruit blacks to fight in the North. Robert E. Lee proposes using blacks in the Confederacy Army and emancipating them if necessary. However, another general angrily retorts, "If slaves will make good soldiers, our whole theory of slavery is wrong." Duh. More First Nation Native American news in 1887, the Blackfoot Treaty. Surrendering 50,000 square miles, slightly less than the size of the state of Washington in southwest Alberta. According to Blackfoot Chief Yellowhorn, chiefs never touched the pen and signed the treaties. The treaties were fraudulent. The chiefs were not told what was going on and did not have anyone to explain it to them. They have stolen our nationality from us. We are not Canadian nor Americans. We are Blackfoot. More governmental terrorism happens on this date in 1985 when the French finally admit planting a bomb that sunk the Greenpeace Rainbow Warrior ship in New Zealand. Also on September 22nd in 2001, New York City announces a $9 million settlement for Abner Louima for the police torture that happened 4 years earlier is when police beat and sodomized Abner with a plunger. This week in Radical History for September 23rd, Victoria Woodhull would be born on this date in 1838. She was an American suffragette who helped publicize the Golden Age newspaper. As a leader of the American woman suffragette movement in the 19th century, she became a colorful and notorious symbol for women's rights, free love, and labor reform, as well as the first woman to run for president of the United States in 1872. Also for September 23, 1950, Congress overrides President Truman's veto and passes the McCarran Internal Security Act, requiring registration of members of groups the Attorney General determines to be communist fronts and establishing emergency concentration camps. Truman would call the act the greatest danger to freedom of speech, press, and assembly since the Alien and Sedition Laws of 1798. Today, KBR and Halliburton subsidiaries receive U.S. grants to build concentration camps throughout the United States, the biggest one in Alaska, where I'm sure the Palin family would volunteer to round up any commies sent their way. Two more items for September 23, 1983. National Kidney Foundation president decries as immoral and unethical a plan by Virginia Dr. H. Barry Jacobs to buy kidneys from poor people, among them residents of the third world nations, and sell them to wealthier people who need kidney transplants. Of course, to this day, selling of body parts to wealthier folks is standard operating procedure in a lot of third world nations. On eBay. Lastly, for September 23rd, 1997, anti-authoritarian anarcho-punk album Tub Thumper by the anarchist singing group Chumbawamba is released. Here's a little sample, a taste, a tease, if you will, a little more Chumbawamba.
A man walks into a think tank full of hooch and future sales, mixing wish lists with extension plans, read Guantanamo jail. Smell a solid beach, and a whiff of cannot fail, and a guilt trait shop with goblets, tripping cutthroat cocktails, and they drink a toast to Florida, and all its air-conditioned hum, and they damn the health of Cuba, and they damn its bona fide rum, he sips a Calamata olive.
In the canteen down at Columbine, with
flags they never
found, striking matches up at
Waco
when they
burnt it
to the ground. Without me,
Oklahoma
wasn't
possible
at all.
See my silhouette
in the Super 8
around
the grassy knoll.
Everything you know is wrong. There's a verse missing out of the song.
This week in Radical History for September 24, 1794, President Washington orders militia to put down Whiskey Rebellion. Farmers in the western frontier revolt when the U.S. government attempts to tax the farmers' excess grain use that they use to make whiskey. Tom the Tinker and others help organize a rebellion which mostly targeted tax collectors and their offices. The rebellion would eventually be put down by Washington himself. Also on September 24, 1901, anarchist and feminist Emma Goldman released from jail. Authorities had tried to make the case linking her to assassination of beloved President McKinley, but they would drop charges due to lack of evidence. In Wisconsin news in this date, in 1968, anti-war protesters destroy 10,000 draft files in Milwaukee. Lastly, for September 24th, 1969, Chicago 8 conspiracy trial begins. As U.S. government tries to put to trial 8 demonstrators and blame them for the massive disruption of the Democratic National Convention. At the end, the U.S. government was shown once again how much of an ass they can be. Now, after the RNC in St. Paul, a version of the Chicago 8 trials are being organized as 8 members of the RNC Welcoming Committee is being prosecuted on terrorism charges.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح. طفلة.
Good morning, everyone. And welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is so important that we present it here each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. This morning we have a conversation with a remarkable Palestinian storyteller, Fida Ataya, which took place during her tour of the United States, where she is conducting workshops and speaking throughout the Northeast. Fida discovered the power of storytelling on the knee of her grandmother, and as an educator is now using it as her means of teaching and resisting. She understands the power of storytelling, and I asked her to tell her story. Well, Fida, welcome to This Week in Palestine. It's lovely to meet you. Your reputation precedes you. We've heard about you from friends here and the work that you're doing, so it's very exciting that you're here. And really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you and for you to share your story with our audience. So let's begin with your story. Who are you? Where did you grow up? How did you get into theater and storytelling? And how do you see your mission in terms of the use of your talents with people in Palestine?
So I was born in Ramallah, as well as I live in a village next to Ramallah called Kafr Naama, far away from the center, 15 kilometers. I live with my parents. Mm-hmm. I grew up in this village with the nature, with the mountains, with really a little bit and a lot of playing and hiking on the ground, here, up to the trees, you know, just like really real, natural child. Hood, yani growing up. And then yani I have like 4 brothers and 3 sisters, and we all 10 with my parents, and I used to live in a social place in a village. We used to have some sheep, and we used to have a lot of friends coming, going, a lot of cousins, neighbors. We all used to be together, playing together, even each other working together, as well as I was really child, and I used to learn a lot of things in the same time, which the place I was used to live in, like a lot of things going on, you know? Even you are in the village, where a really quiet place, but many things happening in the same time. I was born in 20 of February 1987. My name is Fida, and Fida name means like you give your soul for something for free. So,
lovely name.
Who gave me that name? My uncle.
Ah.
My uncle. When my mom was pregnant, he came girl or boy? Then she said, I don't know really. And then he asked her, if she will be female, you must call her like Fida.
Oh,
and
nice.
She said, okay, if we were a girl, we call her Fida. And he said, no, Fida Eya should be. It means like Fida Eya, like the freedom fighter.
Oh.
We call Fida'i, and Fida'iya, women freedom fighter. And as I told you, I was born 20 of February 1987, and my uncle, he became a martyr 20 of February 1988.
Oh.
In the same day.
Same day as your birthday.
Thank you. After 1 year, he passed away in the old city of Ramallah, and he became the first martyr in the old city of Ramallah in the first intifada. Guess. I grew up with family who listed two people, like two martyrs in the first intifada, as well as they used to be active in a popular struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up with this. I used to go to the child club, to the school, kindergarten. We used to play a game I still remember. We used to bake flowers, and we brought like a black vibes, a plastic one. We roll it as a circle, and we used to have like from the huge tree trenches, and we used to roll it around with the flowers, and we used to play the game of martyrs.
Play the game of martyrs?
Yes.
Wow.
As I still remember this, I became conscious about the things I was playing when I grew up.
I know.
Then I used to play that game, as well I used to play like this game, the demonstration game. Ta ta ta, ta 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 ta, like one, yeah. Two, three.
Yeah.
You know? Without conscious, that things was going on affected me as a child who was living in this quiet, beautiful, natural place in Palestine. Without conscious, that happened to me.
Hmm.
As well, just was in the first intifada when I was like my mom told me I was really peppy, and the Israeli are surrounded the house and the village. Then they start to throw the gas and the bombing, and entered the house the gas. Then I became like I could not breathe, and they took and they saved my life in the last minute because I was really peppy, and the people
were suffocating.
Yes, they survived. Yeah, they saved my life in the last minute, as my mom told me. And this is nothing. Just like we are living at that's marks that we are living under the Israeli occupation.
This is normal life. This is, yeah.
This is minimum things.
Yeah.
What's happened to my family? This is maybe minimum things, small things comparing with huge things happening.
What other people?
Was in the same time in Palestine. So I grew up little by little. I went to the school in the village, and I finished the school. I was very active, playing sport, running, having many things. Then in the end, just like I went to the university to study like finance, then I recognized that it's not mine.
You went to Al-Quds University?
To Anarwa College
to
study finance. Then I changed the course. I went to study education, as I am, like I want to study education.
Mm-hmm.
Before, I just was wondering who I am.
Yeah.
Who I am, really, in this crazy place. One day I remember myself at the class at the university with a professor. He was telling us about how to be in the educational system. You should be respectful, you should be nice with all, you should prepare everything, you should be like that person who the children will look forward to you, like to be with you and to be like that. In the same date of this professor who was saying that to us in this, I used to sit in the middle of the class having my pencil and writing notes, as well as I used to study, but just only from the notes I took. And that day was a strike for the schools. The children on the street. Mm-hmm. There is no schools anymore.
No school. No.
Okay. The professor, he's enjoying the class, and he's telling this for us. And I broke the pencil. Then because there is no sound except my pencil, they all looked at me and they start to laugh. And the teacher said, "What's wrong with you, Fidel?" I said, "What's wrong with you, my teacher? You didn't see the children on the street? They did not go to the school? What's to be respectful? What's this mean to be like in this educational system, which is really, it seems, fake one with this circumstances we are living in? Why you didn't discuss about that? Why you didn't make that big, huge now discussion about what's really going on in the reality? Why we should play on the sky what's underground that's broken? Why? I'm not going to be in your course. I'm sorry. Mm. I must leave right now." I left his course. I did not come back to his course. Then I was asking myself who I am, what I want from this life. To be involved with this educational fake system? Or to be like fighting, I don't know, this shit incubation came to us since 70 years ago? Or what? Or no, to hide myself, closing my eyes, ears, and relax and live my fake normal time and life in Palestine. What shall I do? Then in this moment came to my brain the memory of my grandma. My grandma, she's blonde, as well as she could not move her leg and hand for she had a heart attack.
So she had a paralysis?
Yes. Mm-hmm. For her, because she was very sad for her only son, the Israelis, kicked him outside of the country. So she became very angry, very sad, until she became blonde. And she had the heart attack. This is very important. I used to sit on her leg.
On your lap. Yeah.
Thank you. And she used to tell a story, not only for me, for other children from my family.
Yeah.
And I can remember until now the feeling like I'm sitting on the cloud, flying in the sky, everywhere, having the freedom from the story.
Mm. It was just transported by the story.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. Which make me feel, oh, yes! Maybe I want to
That's
be like grandma.
Ah.
I went, Mama, see, this happened. I don't like what's going on. And she said, okay, I want to be like my grandma, like your mom.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, what? What do you mean by that? I said, I want to tell stories. And she said, no, you are killing me. Now you are really killing me. What? You are studying baccalaureus right now. And you want to be like old-fashioned women telling stories? Are you using your brain? I said, I want to tell you, Mom, how much important to tell stories in Palestine. I went outside the house. I was looking around children. Hi, child. Do you know that story? Hassan Shatter. He said, no. Do you know Ahdadun's story? No. Do you know Al-Khunfus' story? No. All the children, they don't know the stories, the traditional Palestinian stories. How I can be Palestinian without know anything about our heritage, our traditional Palestinian stories? How I can be? Then, shui shui, little by little, was crazy, because in that time, that was 10 years ago, you don't have any women, a storyteller, her profession to tell a story in Palestine. Mm-hmm. For who I'm looking forward? Only for my grandma, which used to tell not in public spaces. But I'm in big challenge. How I can make like people believe me and calling for me and asking me to tell stories. And I'm not that person who's really good in speaking. I'm that person who's really good in, she's good in running and flying and playing, you know, laying around. I'm not that person, Yani. What I did with myself? Why I do that? And why I did that in my life? why I put myself in the fire? Why? Then I said, okay, you put yourself there in the fire because this is the only way to be. Otherwise, you will be like following others.
Mm-hmm.
You will be like tool for others. And that means you will be like not a human being.
Mm.
So, yalla, tell stories. Okay, I will continue my education then, in baccalaureate in education. I finished it. That will help me a lot to see the education of storytelling. Then, yes, I must learn as much as we can from the old people. They are still alive in Palestine. I was traveling here, there, in my village, other villages, to meet that people. I was listening from them, hearing from them, just like got to know close, and we are really friends, good friends together, as we still, old Palestinians, men and women, especially women. Then I said, okay, fine. Traditional Palestinian stories, but I'm 20, 21. The traditional story is very deep. Sometimes maybe I tell something, the deep meaning which I don't know. Yes, drama in education. To study drama in education, that will help me to analyze the story.
Comes together.
Exactly. Three years of drama in education.
Mm-hmm.
I was studying, applying, even the researches I did about storytelling, you know? The three researches for the 3 years. The last one I did... The last research I wrote about, you know, I proved that the story is exactly the drama, as well as the element of the drama exactly is the element of the story. Okay, perfect, with that, I became very active in Palestine. I used to tell a lot of stories everywhere. I do remember 2009 when the Ministry of Culture called me to perform in the middle of Ramallah Old City, outdoor performance. It was like part of Heritage Day, Palestine Heritage Day. Then I looked to myself like that. It was a huge, many people outside, all kinds of people, and they are waiting for something they don't know what this will be. And I said in the mic, let's welcome the storyteller who will tell us the story. And they looked, what's this? But they were not caring about me, you know. They were talking to each other and just like outside the outdoor, yani. Then I stepped. Before I stepped, I went back quickly looking to the old shop. I went to this traditional Palestinian dress. I took it from here. I wear it quickly. I went back to the stage. Then no one looked at me even. Okay, never mind. Then I started my story. Jam, jam, yama, jam. Once, time ago. Did jam in Kabil, did jam. Here is store beside the store. Little by little, I can see all the faces like... Then... Looking to this young girl, let's say young woman, telling story. That action, I did not expect that we will listen even, because we are not good in listening as Palestinians. We have a lot of things to do, and we are not really good. So that make me more believe in what the things I'm doing, something really rare, you know? Unique. Also, people, they're hearing me like that, Palestinians, and they asked me for to repeat the story when I finished. Just like huge things. 2008, when I went to the school to tell the story, first time when I started, the teacher said, what you are going to do? I said, oh, I'm going to tell a story. I'm a storyteller. And she said, what? Habibti, my love, please don't do that. If you are a clown, you are welcome. If not, I'm not going to make my students lay down and sleep after your story. I will make them like active. I said, oh, why you judge me like that? Why you don't want to enter and watch the things I'm doing? I would love to invite you to be in the class and to see. Just give me like 40 minutes. And that's the things I want to ask you forever. And she said, oh, why she speaks like that? Okay, welcome. I entered. It was like for the third grade. I told them story. It was very interactive performance, very nice performance about women has no children and she found a cat. But the Palestinian story, and the teacher was sitting as the children were all sitting and listening, interacting, and the teacher she became very crazy when the ending was the ending of the performance. She came to me and she said, tell me when you would like to come back. I would love to just host you again and again and again. Just like I did not expect. I thought that you are a very boring person. And just like, so, to build that skill in my body, in my soul, it was very hard. To use my body freely, just come by years. To have that knowledge of storytelling and a lot of stories in my body, in my brain, that's make me like travel in whole Palestine, listen to the stories from many people, old people, listening to the old stories, which really give you crazy energy when you listen to the stories. And that things, I used it on a stage. I do improvise a lot. And the people can clearly believe the stories I'm telling them. Because I do believe all the stories I just tell for the people just because I don't lie. It's just really, that's a story, that's character. I don't act the stories because I am the storyteller, you know? And then I said, okay, fine. During the period, I decided to be a storyteller. I took like more than 25 workshops inside Palestine, outside Palestine about storytelling. About storytelling, the traditional Palestinian stories, storytellers from France, Germany, Sweden, also Lebanon, U.S., Britain, I was involved with everything around storytelling inside Palestine and outside Palestine. So I started to create my own performances based on my experience, okay? And which really make me more and more stronger and because I do apply and I have the experience in the real location. Then I said, okay. Real stories. A friend of mine, she's Swedish. We used to work together, and she invited me to the Freedom Theater to lead with her drama and education project. As well as I finished my drama and education, then she said, and also please, can you make like a storytelling workshop for children and performances every month. They said, yes, that would be nice. Then I started that. Then I noticed that they have like a Ben River who was leading the Freedom Bus 2011. Then I got involved with the things he's doing, and he said, like, we are doing playback. I was very excited to know more about the playbacks because it was like very new in Palestine. Okay, very nice. I think he said, yes, I want to learn that because it's about real stories. About real stories, which I'm not really expert to tell. I'm expert in traditional stories, myths, and things like that, but not real stories. So I just said, halas, I want to study that. Then I start to perform in the playback theater group in Palestine with the Freedom Bus, making performances, storytelling performances, also playback performances, as well as I was also teaching playback at South in Hebron Hills with Ben Rivers. That's helped me in my storytelling as a profession. It's helped me to improvise more and more and to be courage on a stage. And that's something unique to see me because I'm wearing scarf, which I came from a Islamic family. And I came from a village. It's not popular to see a female wearing scarf, came from village. We're from Islamic family, and she do this kind of work. She go and sleep on the mountain, in the tent, and live in the refugee camp alone, and coming to city, traveling outside Palestine. Something unique to find this in Palestine, and especially I told you about this, Yani. And thanks God, because I have supportive family, which they really supporting me, as well as I have very nice friends inside and outside Palestine, which really I believe them, and we believe each other, and hold together, we can make change really. So why I do that? I do that because without your tongue, how you can be? How we can be a story about Palestinians without being, without having any story? I can see Palestine land started to be disappear little by little. And now in West Bank, we are living as Palestinians on a little piece of land divided by colonies and wall. Okay? How can be Palestinians without having a story? Can we create state then? I don't think we be state without story, even state without land. So in the same time, the land disappearing, as well as the Israeli occupation is still taking the land, as water, as everything, should not the story go away. The story should stand.
Yes.
Exactly the story. Mm. And our Nakba in 1948 is approved for our energy and power of the, our storytelling method. I used to work with the female in Burj Barajan refugee camp in Lebanon. They are Palestinians and everything. They learn about Palestine from who? From their grandma, father, old people. They used to tell them stories about Palestine and things like that. So the storytelling is very powerful method.
For generations, that's the way education, that's how you taught. You taught with through storytelling,
yeah.
You know. And it's interesting the way you talk about it now, that it's somehow been lost, that, or the value of it has been lost. And you see that. The importance of that, and that you're restoring, in a sense, you're, you know, bringing it back, but which is so important because it's been lost.
Yes, yes. About that, you only one person maybe can make change, but I'll little bit change. So about that, I went there, trying to extend. The things I'm doing as much as I can, as I see there's no, we must make a festival for starting in Palestine with another friends in Jordan because they started that. I used to be with them. Then it's continue with Palestine, and we did like last year a storytelling festival in Palestine with 37 storytellers from Palestine.
Mm.
You are not alone.
Mm.
I jumped when we received the application, me and my friend, and I looked, I counted, I said, no, I don't believe that. Mm. Just like incredible.
You're not alone.
Yes, incredible. Incredible because you see new people started to be storytellers. As they want to be storytellers, you know, as their profession. You inspire others also, you know. You open the gate for others to wear a scarf and to be in a stage in the same time. Okay? Mm-hmm. And to wear a scarf and to travel all the world, you know. You are not, no one can limit you. No one can put border for you to stop your freedom. You decide yourself how you want to be in Palestine, outside Palestine. How you want to be as Palestinian, as rooted, as you must be. Mm. Otherwise, you will be disappearing like I don't know what. You know, that's allowed me to go to Sweden for the festival there, storytelling festival, Edinburgh, we'll go to the French festival, and also as well to England, to the Brighton University, also to Tunisia, Carthage Theatre Festival for two times, a Jordan Hakaya Festival, storytelling festival for like 9 years. I was participating in this festival, Algeria, the storytelling festival, as well as like Italy. I used to work with a theater reportage, Teatro di Nascosto, a hidden theater in Italy, in Volterra, with Annette Hinnemann, who used to tell real stories. I am part of international group. We work all together. We make performances and improvisation everywhere, in France, Spain, on the beach, in the garden, in the street. Mm. Never mind. Work about the dreams, working about the real stories, about many, many things. Yani, about that, I said, okay, Palestine now. Yes, art and activism residency based on the storytelling should be in Palestine. Now, two, three, four, 5. Oh, I must investigate with Palestinians. No, should be many Palestinians, but it's for free. But it's not paid work. What shall I do? It was very, very challenge. It's easy to tell, easy to say. I'm now saying with my body, with my soul, talking to you. But it was very hard. You just decide to don't create your own personal life because you are taken from something else. And you must be focusing on these things.
Mm-hmm.
Because you are responsible as a Palestinian to share the story as much as you can to others Palestinians, to make them learn about their roots. Then second, to non-Palestinians, to make them learn about Palestine. And just like after years, I realized that, oh my God, what is this? Who I am? I just, all the things I do for others. What about myself, you know?
Mm-hmm.
What about myself? No, just like make me like, I'm really tired from the things. Why I must do that?
Yeah.
Why I must be responsible about the things happening since years in Palestine? Why? I dream because one day one journalist asked me, what is your dream? Then I stopped. I looked. Then I stood there. To be honest, I don't know. And she said, no, we know that your dream to be a storyteller and to tell Palestinian story as much as you can. I said, no, don't you. That's my dream. I'm sorry. That's not my dream anymore. It just wasn't even my dream. That was responsibility and decision. I decided. The dream to just sit under the tree, relaxing,
mm-hmm.
breathing, drinking water from the spring, eating from the food I plant, having little sheep, can give me milk.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. I don't want any things in this life. I don't want to dream. I'm not a dreamer to dream to have something big. I don't like. I'm not that person who's looking to be famous, as well as I'm that person. About that, I work with really Palestinians who really have no things. I don't have Facebook page,
mm-hmm.
even. Just a month ago, I have my card. If you look to my experience, I'm expert in storytelling. Mm-hmm. So why I'm doing that? Because the people who I'm looking for to them, they are really different. So it's just like this. Yeah, I mean, what we need as Palestinians in this earth, we need our land. We need to breathe, to sit, relax. As a minimum human being sitting anywhere in the world, you know, with our land.
Just want to live your life as you define it. As you, that's
with minimum.
That's the vision.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it's not my
define
dream.
Define your life.
Yeah. Yeah, and I feel like a huge things on my shoulders, you know, with the things I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
That always pushing me to do the things as much as I can without stopping. And this is, I don't have any holiday in my life, as I don't.
No holiday?
No holiday.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's a lot. Maybe that's, maybe I do something bad for myself.
Mm-hmm.
But I live in an urgent emergency situation. Every second the Israeli come and take our land. Just 3 weeks ago in my village, with my favorite place ever, I was thinking to just live in this under the tree up to the hill, up to the tree, up to the mountain, and I wasn't in the village because I used to travel everywhere in Palestine. I was in another city called Tulkarem in West Bank.
Sure.
Then I surprised when I back home that the settlers, the colonists, they are up to the hill. They took the hill, the soldiers. I went with my dog. My mom said, where are you going to? I said, I'm going to hike as usual up to the mountain. And she said, are you crazy? You don't see the demonstration right now? You cannot hear the bombing? The shooting? Are you going to kill yourself? I said, no, Mama. I'm going to walk as every Friday with my dog.
Mm.
It's my act of freedom. It's my, yeah.
Exactly. I went there. The Israeli soldiers did not let me just go where the, I go normally, up to the mountain, because they said, this is the military area now. They took the land. As a family, we own land there. We have papers, you know? What's this right you have as a colonists to come and take our land? They have gun. They have everything. They can make the Palestinians scared to being like, to otherwise would be killed as Palestinians. Then they would say, oh, Palestinians, they are terrorists. They throw stones. What? That we are throwing stones? You are taking our time like this. What this? Mm-hmm. Where's the justice? I was looking to other Palestinians, sharing with them, being with them, being in solidarity with them about what's happening in their land. And now it's our turn. It's my turn as my village.
Mm-hmm.
Just 3 weeks ago. I'm not happy to be in U.S. as well as what's going on. And this politic and the government of U.S., what they are doing. And always they have new things to make us falling down and
right.
to make the occupation up to the sky.
Supporting the occupation,
exactly.
supporting the military in
exactly.
Israel.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But I can see the peaceful U.S. people population, friends I have here, which really they are really supportive for Palestine and for our issue. I don't know what we call it. Our Palestine things, our... So, this is in general about me.
You used... talk a bit about the Freedom Theater in Jenin, and in particular, playback theater, and what that is, and how that's used, and how that is part of the resistance.
Yeah. It's everything's part of the resistance. This woman who is living in the tent in Jordan Valley with the 5 sheep without water, without electricity, without education for her children, while she's sitting there without anything, she's resisting. Otherwise, the Israeli settlers, colonists, will come and take her land.
Right.
She's resisting.
Right.
That farmer who's going every Saturday, Friday, Sunday, every day, morning early to his mountain to plant and to make the sand in good way and the stones to make his land better,
mm-hmm.
that he is resisting in Palestine. When you go and tell stories, you are resisting. And what... I used to work with the Freedom. I worked with the Freedom Theater as well. We are going now to. I am going to be part of the new production, both skateboarding and storytelling about freedom. To be honest, about birds and freedom. Freedom Theater. I was co-leading the Freedom Bus for 2 years,
mm-hmm.
as well as I was part of the Freedom Bus for 4 years. I used to tell stories doing playback theater, and also I used to lead the tour. For the group, the passengers in whole West Bank in Area C, as you know, in Palestine,
yeah.
in West Bank, divided the land after the agreement of Oslo agreement, Palestinian Israeli, I'm sorry to say that it's shit agreement, mm-hmm. and they divided A, B, C in the land, and A for Palestinians and under control Palestinians is 18%, B for Palestinians and under control both Israelis and Palestinians, and it's about 22nd percent, and C it's for Palestinians under control Israelis, it's about 60% from the whole West Bank. If we look 60% as Palestinians, the Israeli government did not allow to us to build houses, to have water, to be access in education, to build healthy center or a school. That means you are not allowed to be. You mm-hmm. are not allowed to be in this earth. As much as they can, they're trying to kick us out. Mm-hmm. The Freedom mm-hmm. Bus used to have a Palestinians, international activist artist, students even, doctors and universities, professors. they used to all be together, traveling from north of West Bank until south of West Bank, passing the communities who's living in Area C, be in solidarity with them, living with them, hearing from them, doing a voluntary work with them, you know, also showing them some theater, a storytelling, music, and that Freedom Bus Playback Theater. The Playback Theater, it's an interactive theater based on stories came from the teller, real audience from the audience. And we do have like four actors, one a musician, one conductor. And we invite, the conductor invite one of the audience to be a teller on a stage. And he or she used to tell a story in public for all. And then the conductor asks the actors to play back the story in front of her or him in the middle of this Palestine. As well as the teller choose every time someone from the actors to be him or her.
So you're asking people in the audience who came to tell their story, and they get up and they tell their story, and then the actors improvise and play back the story that the audience participant just gave. That's playback theater.
Yes, and that's very nice method to be in solidarity with other people. To I forgot the word in English. Advocacy. Yeah, advocacy. That's advocacy tool.
Advocacy.
Yes, advocacy tool to highlight something or to make an audience for something. Because our heroes at the playback performances was the community members.
Yeah.
The tellers.
Right.
They are the heroes in the stage. That will make other Palestinians believe them and be in solidarity with them. Second, will make the teller look at him or her story, analyze. What's this? Also reflect. Also evaluate.
Mm-hmm.
Third, that will be very nice educational method to learn from our experiences as Palestinians. And fourth, to build an audience for our crazy life, to be aware about what's going on through these performances. Fifth, to make that teller and others release a little bit and relax after they see their themselves on the stage. They will be relaxed a little bit.
So there's real therapy. It's real. It's a release.
Yes.
And when you live under occupation, and when you live under the kind of terror that Palestinians live with every day, that becomes very important.
That's like make you proud of yourself as Palestinian under occupation, living in very tough days, hard, crazy, many things going on. You're just struggling to survive, to be.
The purpose of the occupation is to break you. And this is a way that people who are powerless in many ways, don't have the guns, they don't have the control, are able to resist by telling their stories and in a sense emboldening each other to stand against this oppression. And that's the role. That's what you're doing. That's what you're doing. Very incredibly important.
This is the minimum, to be honest.
Yeah.
This is the minimum. We don't have anything anymore as we used to have. By years we are losing a lot of things. As the, if there's a cutter will come and cut our tongue, that will be our ending as Palestinians. That's, I hope there will be not any more cutters will come and cut our tongue. About that, telling stories with all kind of methods is the most powerful, more than anything else. It's just most powerful form of a story of resistance, I think.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing form of resistance. Minimum.
So this is empowerment. This is what you're about. Is empowerment of people by telling their stories and by being who they are, being who you are.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Being how you are is something not easy in Palestine.
And you know, we hear so often about the resistance and why the Palestinian people will grow is because of the power of their heritage and the power of their history and the love of the land. And there's no way you ultimately break that. And but it's so painful to see the suffering that goes on during this, it's amazing. It's amazing that that the resistance is so strong in the spirit of the people. That's what I see.
Yeah. Personally, my energy comes from underground, as like the roots of the olive tree.
Mm-hmm.
As I always, when I teach storytelling for others, I tell them this: be as an olive tree rooted in the earth, down,
right.
down, then fly with your leaves far away, everywhere. Otherwise, will be a cutter. It's easy if you don't have that root, will come and catch you and just throw you here or there. Someone or something would break you easily. About that, be rooted as much as you can to be a storyteller. That will help you to stay and to survive and to just be strong as you must be with your spirit and your body. And your stories, experiences, as struggle, as to be honest, we must be like faithful for our martyrs and the people who was killed in Palestine from the occupation.
That's right.
We must be faithful.
That's right.
Minimum things we are doing.
Yeah.
We must respect their blood.
That's right.
For a struggle, they were struggling, just like they were just giving themselves like that, you know. They don't care about anything. They were just like walking. It's very easy for the occupation to kill. Very easy. Just like we are not even animals. We are less than animals. It seems that we are like a little small plastic buckets. But no. We are a lot of things. We are big things. We are everything, as I know. Okay. Maybe we don't know exactly the way for freedom, but see, one day I went back home after traveling. I love my family house, which have a lot of animals up to the sky. You can see a lot of birds. Then one day I back home. I looked up. I'm really happy to back home. Then I looked. Then I did not find the birds. I was very angry. Where's the birds? Look around here, there. I'm behind the house. Then I found the birds on the cage. Oh, my God. Birds on the cage in our house. Crazy. That's incredible. That's unbelievable. Where's my mom? I just opened the door like that. My mom... cooking maklouba, enjoying the smell. She saw me. Oh, Fida, you came back. Come and hug me. I said, no, Mama, I'm not going to hug you. Who put the doves, the birds, on the cage? And she said, oh, my God. Oh, your brother, he did that. Where is my brother then? Your brother, he's in the work. You know that he will come after 4 hours. I said, okay. And she said, yalla, food is ready. No. I'm not going to eat from this food until I see why my brother bought that birds on the cage. The food became cold. No one ate from the food. My brother came after 4 hours. Fida, you came back, come! Why you are not standing up even? Why you are not exciting to meet me? I said, okay, Habibi, my love. Tell me, why you put the doves, birds, on the cage? I know that you were in the Israeli prison. You was in the prison for 5 years. How you could do that, my brother? Put that birds on the cage. And he said, looked at me with smile this is the only things you saw? I said, yes, this is the only thing I saw, and this is the only things I can believe how the occupation changed you. And he said, Fida, relax. You did not see the gate of that cage open, and the doves, birds could not go out. They don't know their way to the freedom. This is not my fault.
So the cage door was open and the doves didn't walk out. They stayed in the cage. They could have gone out and they didn't.
Maybe we have to search to find way for our freedom.
Yeah.
In the middle of this crazy cage we are living in. Mm. Or in the middle of this life.
Oh. Well, Fida, thank you. Thank you for this story. Thank you for what you're doing and sharing it with us. It's amazing. I hope this is the beginning of a relationship. I hope we'll see you often and be able to talk again. There's so much to talk about, and wish you much success.
Thank you. Thank you really so much, because you are helping me and helping other Palestinians' voices to just fly everywhere and to be cached from other people who live everywhere in the world. Mm-hmm. With the things you are doing, I really appreciate so much, because that's kind of storytelling you are doing for helping us to survive. You are like holding us, just being with us, helping us to be like here, there, to make aware about Palestine. Thank you so much, John.
People need to hear your voice. I hope we can be a part of that.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, unwelcome guests.
To the rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Tonight we're going to look at biotechnology and agriculture. First, we'll bring you excerpts from a symposium on biotechnology and food that took place in Syracuse last month. Then we'll hear about biodiversity and biopiracy from internationally recognized activist and expert Vandana Shiva.
I'm Chris Sturr. Next on Unwelcome Guests, we will hear selections from a symposium on biotechnology and food, which was held last month in Syracuse, and which was sponsored by Cornell Cooperative Extension of Onondaga County.
I'd like to welcome you on behalf of our association and Kathy Dishner, the other extension educator, and myself. I'm Ed Stair with Cornell Cooperative Extension of Onondaga County. And what we've assembled here today is a very diverse group of presenters to present the latest findings in biotechnology. It's such a complex issue, and we've organized this as an open forum to present numerous sides in this issue. It's not black and white. There are no straight answers, and people may often walk away with more questions than answers after certain forums. But after this, we hope by presenting everything that you, in turn, may make more informed decisions when it comes to biotechnology.
The first speaker at the symposium was Dr. Margaret Smith of Cornell University, who is a half-time faculty member in the Department of Plant Breeding and halftime associate director of Cooperative Extension.
Due to a technical problem, our recording of Dr. Smith's presentation was lost, so I'll summarize the highlights for you as I understood them. She said, DNA carries the genetic blueprints of life. She explained that the genetic code of all life forms is remarkably similar in that there are only four subtypes of DNA which, in combination, make up the genetic instructions for all organisms, whether a fruit fly, a corn plant, or a human being. Scientists represent these code fragments with four letters of the alphabet. The differences between a fruit fly and a human being result, then, from the number and arrangement of these four basic units. Just as all information on a computer ultimately can be broken down to the numbers 1 and 0. On the molecular level, a cell sees a string of instructions consisting of arrangements of these four elements. And from that perspective, nothing differentiates a gene from one organism from that of another. That is why it is possible to insert a gene from one organism into the cell of another completely different organism. For the cell, it's just more code, and it keeps on reading that code along with the code that was already part of its genetic structure. Human beings have billions of sequences of genetic code, while a fruit fly has only a few million. The more complex the organism, the more code sequences. Most people think that animals must be more complex than plants, so it might surprise you to know that a corn plant has a genetic code that is far more complex than a fruit fly's. So from the standpoint of complexity, that is, numbers of gene sequences, a corn plant is closer to a human being than a fruit fly. From the scientific point of view, all our food crops have been genetically modified, as they have been selectively bred over several millennia and are now quite different from their wild ancestors. So, scientists use the term genetic engineering to refer to organisms created by the insertion of DNA from one species into the cell of a plant or animal of another entirely different species, which would normally not be able to interbreed, such as a bacteria and a corn plant. Genetic traits are expressed in several ways. In some cases, one gene will contain the instructions for a specific characteristic, such as the production of a toxic substance. In other cases, a trait of an organism results from the interrelationship of many genes, not just one gene alone, and this process is quite far from being understood. Are there risks involved in genetically engineered crops? Yes, and Dr. Smith's view was that GE crops should be looked on at a case-by-case basis with regard to whether the risks outweigh the potential benefits. Thus far, only a few genetically engineered organisms have been commercialized. The first was the production of a synthetic rennet for cheese making, replacing the use of an enzyme taken from the intestines of calves. This synthetic enzyme has been in use for more than a decade. There have also been pharmaceutical applications for genetically engineered substances, such as insulin, which Dr. Smith said has been extremely beneficial for patients suffering from diabetes. Genetically engineered food crops, which have been widely commercialized in agriculture, mainly consist of modifications designed to control pests or to resist herbicides, such as Monsanto's Roundup Ready corn, soybeans, and oil rapeseed. The claim is that these Roundup Ready varieties will reduce the use of pesticides overall and have a positive effect on the environment. Other modifications, such as the Flavor Saver tomato, were designed to allow produce to have a longer shelf life. The Flavor Saver tomato was a commercial failure because it did not taste good. Dr. Smith said that a type of tomato which was not particularly tasty was used as a base crop, and she implied that it was that, not the genetic engineering of the tomato, that led to the poor taste. Dr. Smith's presentation left one with the impression that scientists regard genetically engineering of crops as another type of plant breeding system, along a continuum that includes selective breeding and hybridization. Cross-pollinating two different varieties of a plant to create a third with the best of both parents' characteristics. Techniques that are now called classical breeding techniques to differentiate them from genetically engineered varieties.
The next speaker at the symposium was Dorothy Rosa Harris, a registered dietitian at Community General Hospital in Syracuse, speaking on health and nutritional concerns with genetically modified organisms.
I think we need to keep Margaret's comment about risks and benefits very much in mind as we go through this part of the program on are there any health concerns with genetically modified organisms in our food. One of the things that I've always felt for years is as I practice as a dietitian, I'm actually looking at patients with my flashlight. And sometimes my flashlight is on for a fleeting second. Sometimes it's on for a longer time period as I try to understand what I about this patient and how to put together their health care program. Sometimes I'm using a very small pen light that's on my keychain. Other times I've got a big enough flashlight that I could be a guard and put a full beam of light on the patient. I want you to keep this illustration a little bit in mind as we go through this information. Our first concern that comes to mind when we start to talk about health concerns here is when we look at food hypersensitivity. Now, I know that all of you recall the ins and outs of normal immune response, that a foreign substance called an antigen triggers the production of antibodies, and those antibodies then fit all around that antigen when it comes into the body again and just destroys it and removes it from the system. The problem that we have when we have an allergic reaction is that it will trigger off a set of inappropriate defense mechanisms. And the term allergy is a very encompassing term. It can mean anything from asthma to hay fever to eczema, and even the most serious is anaphylactic shock. Now, why this becomes of concern in food allergies is that once it's determined that a person has a food hypersensitivity, the only proven theory that we can, or therapy that we can use, is strict elimination of that particular offending allergen. So that when we begin to look at changing food slightly, we need to keep this in mind. How big a problem could this be? Well, we know that 1-2% of people in Western countries have allergy reactions to certain foods types, and 6% of children under the age of 3. We don't really know what the story is in other cultures because the data just has not been able to be collected. The list that physicians generally have available, and I've given you a very extensive list in your handout, lists a lot of foods, and one could quickly look at that and say, well, I guess I can't eat anything if I'm allergic to food. That's why it becomes very important to be very specific. The most common foods that are listed on your handout account for 90% of the allergies in Western cultures. The milk, the eggs, the legumes, the shellfish, the fish, the tree nuts, the cereals. Then we have some less common ones, such as the strawberries, apricots, carrots, celery. That's the physician's list. My list is a little more extensive after practicing dietetics for a number of years, and I note that tomatoes crop up, citrus fruits, pineapple, and then there's those favorites of mine that show up on a lot of people's list called spinach and liver. That's on a lot of patients' list. That one hasn't shown on any physician's list yet. Now, when you start to transfer genes to a food product, the people that have this allergy to that food could still have a problem with it because most of the new proteins present in amounts that in this new food are still a trace amount, but that trace amount is enough to trigger the physiological reaction. So has this concern shown in any of the GMOs? Yes, it has. We had Pioneer Hybrid did some research to genetically modify the soybean with the goal to include the amino acid methionine. Now, the methionine, the intent here was to make a nutritionally complete soybean by having all of the essential amino acids present. The source of the methionine came from the Brazil nut. Now, you see, as soon as I heard this, I said, did you talk to a dietitian or a physician in doing this research? Because that's one of those, it's a big red flag. And apparently they didn't, or they didn't listen. And sure enough, the people who have a Brazil nut allergy presented with having a problem with these soybeans. The research stopped at that point. Now, as a result of Pioneer Hybrid's work, since 1992, the Food and Drug Administration, or the FDA, has required that GMO foods be tested, and if they are made from a food that has a known allergen in it, and if they cause a reaction, then this food cannot be provided to the public, or is not approved. Likewise, if the plant has a food additive that's not on the generally recognized as safe list, that GRAS list, then the FDA approval of the plant is going to be required. The response that Pioneer stopped the research is often given as an example that the regulatory system of this country worked. However, there is a shortcoming here in that this is only looking at foods that we know are a known allergen at this point. It doesn't talk about those foods that are now being produced by putting non-foods into them, such as bacteria. They're not required to be tested. I'm not quite sure how one would do that testing, and maybe we can find out from some of the other speakers if that's even reasonable. But it does lead people to sometimes then conclude that the FDA is very much more for the producer than for the consumer. However, there is a benefit side to this in that perhaps the GMO food could begin to produce foods that reduce the allergenic activity, and that has, in fact, occurred with rice. So we may have a benefit here that we were not able to achieve before. The flashlight beam, and I think it's a full beam going forth on this food hypersensitivity, is very real, and it has been recognized by the FDA. Now let's move on to our next flashlight beam, and that would be our antibiotic resistant microorganisms. The marker genes are placed into these crops for a reason. They've been placed into the Flavor Saver tomatoes, and it was an antibiotic. They either used Kenicin, which is a last resort drug that's used to fight multi-resistant tuberculosis, or neomycin. Into the BT corn, they have placed a resistance to ampicillin. Now, they're placed there so that next to the genes, so that the desired characteristic that they're looking for in that particular plant can be linked, and then when the material is treated with the antibiotic, they can pull out the part that they want to keep, the transformed material, from the untransformed material. So it's part of producing this particular product. There have been a number of studies that have claimed that there's no antibiotic-resistant genes have not presented as a risk to humans or animals. However, there is a concern that antibiotic-resistant genes will be transferred to bacteria living in the guts of humans or animals, and that this could reduce the efficiency of antibiotic drug therapy for that person in the future. Now, this is just a very gray area. We've got zillions more questions than answers in this story. We also need to recognize that although we have a fair amount of antibiotic resistance occurring now, and I've seen it grow tremendously in the last 5 years in my own practice, we have to recognize that this is primarily coming about from overuse and misuse of antibiotics. However, I do think it's of note that the FDA has advised food developers to please avoid marker genes that encode resistance to clinically important antibiotics, so that when I read that the antibiotic that was used on the Flavor Saver tomatoes is the one that is kind of a last resort for multi-resistant tuberculosis, I do become a little bit questioning of that decision. Another area of concern would be with toxins. Now, in 1989, we had L-tryptophan that was being produced as a supplement that was pulled from the market after we had 37 people die in this country, and we had another 1,700 that experienced extremely painful muscle disease. And it was traced to the L-tryptophan, or it was believed that this was the problem. And one of the thoughts was that the bacteria became contaminated during the recombinant DNA process and was the cause of the deadly tryptophan. Now, the problem is that we're never going to know the answer to this one because the manufacturer pulled everything and destroyed it. And so that the questions will continue to be out there, and perhaps we are unable to learn any lessons from that terrible situation. But it does kind of raise a flag that once something is developed, we probably need to be assured that there's a quality control program that is continuing to monitor that product so that these kinds of situations do not occur. We've also had in the potato a piece of research that came out that found damage from this genetically modified potato to the internal organs and the immune system in rats. Now, does that make an impact in us? I don't know. The research was reported in Lancet, and they also found a viral infection in the mucosa of the GI tract that was thought to be most likely due to the genetically modified product that was used to produce this plant. Although this particular research was very nicely presented in Lancet, which is, you know, a respectable journal, there was a heavy deal of criticism that came forth on this particular research because it was lacking in too few animals and there were no controls. Lancet did a number of editorials on why they did this because they felt that the issue was so important to begin to get into the medical literature. Part of the concern is that we have undesirable characteristics that are not necessarily being identified. And sometimes it's the producer of this particular GMO organism has done some research, but have they done it in a way that answers the questions? One of the concerns in looking at some of the presentation for the BT corn was that the research has a sense to it that it was lined up so that there couldn't possibly be a negative answer. They didn't even look at the effects of the BT on the rest of the food chain. They only looked at it with a small group of animals, and then that small group of animals, they didn't even really prove whether they got the BT into themselves, so that they were experimenting with animals that may not have been affected at all or been able to absorb it. More research is needed in this area, and I would classify this as a very weak battery and a very flickering flashlight, so we've got a long ways to go in this one. Another area of concern is in nutrient content. We've had a couple of articles come out. One was in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition that looked at the nutritional comparison of traditional soybeans and a GMO soybean, and they found them comparable, and they looked at much more than protein and carbohydrate and the vitamins and minerals. We also have had LaPay report that there is a decrease in beneficial phytoestrogens in GMO soybeans versus the traditional strains. But I have to tell you that I'm not even sure what I would do with that information, because I'm not at a point of advising people that you're going to need 42 milligrams of phytoestrogens in order to ward off your coronary heart disease. It's like our advances of knowledge is too weak to be able to deal with that information. I will tell you, as a dietitian, I would certainly like to have the GMO products that are made available come forth with nutrient content, because, you know, I just want to know every part of it that I can, and I don't want to trust it that it's like the traditional. I want to know for sure. I also find myself thinking back on when, in 1996, when Alestrel came forward. Now, you know, there was a lot of controversy as to whether that product was of any value or not. But I found it very helpful when the manufacturer sent out information that allowed me to even recognize that if a patient had been consuming these wonderful snack foods and then went for a fecal fat content study, that they would possibly have a positive response. I found it nice to know that. At least I didn't look like a turkey. I mean, I didn't know everything about how this thing was going to go, but I didn't have to feel like I was out in a bizarre little world. And I wasn't chasing after some wild goose chase if I had a patient that all of a sudden presented with high fat content in their fecal fat test. A fifth area is my flashlight beam is looking at cancer. Now, we do know, for example, that the genetically engineered recombinant bovine hormone that's injected into cows to produce a higher amount of milk, that in those particular cows, we began to see an increased amount of insulin-like growth factor, IGF-1. Now, we also know that IGF-1 can survive digestion and absorption in the circulation of rats. And we also know that IGA-1 has been shown to be higher in humans who drink more milk. And we also know that IGA-1 has been shown to increase the risk of several cancers. Whether A plus B plus C gives you cancer, we don't know. There is a need for more research. We also know that in this area, I pose the question that in Roundup Ready pesticide, the Roundup Ready soybeans, that there's a residue in there that's three times the amount that the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, allowed if we were traditionally spraying these soybeans. So that, and EPA did go along with the approval of this, but we don't, you know, it's like there's this big question in my mind, is that really going to be okay, or won't we know until more research is done? The last area is in the creation of new viruses. Here our thought process is we now know that DNA is not broken down in the gut as we once thought, so that genes from ingested GMOs could spread to the bacteria in the gut. That's the thought process. Whether that occurs or not, we don't know. So clearly, more research is needed. The last three concerns that I've mentioned, the nutrient content, the cancer, and the creation of new viruses, I think I probably have the pen light on my keychain at that on those particular situations, and I haven't even been able to unlock my car before the light goes out. So we have a lot of room for improvement here, or for finding information. So my quest to give you an informative, up-to-date presentation has given you a lot of I don't know, and I won't know for quite some time. We have some major concerns in food hypersensitivity and the antibiotic-resistant microorganisms, but the FDA has acknowledged that, and then we have these other four areas of toxins, nutrient content, cancer, and creation of new viruses where we don't have any clear answers. My hope is that our three agencies in this country who overview it are gaining a strength from collaboration and haven't taken the aspect, well, since the other guy's looking at it, I won't get too excited about it. I think that we need to hold a pose that food safety must be ensured as a very core part to this whole issue. I hope I've helped you at least begin to pose the questions.
That was Dorothy Rosa Harris, a registered dietitian at Syracuse Community Hospital, speaking on health risks associated with eating transgenic foods. The next speaker was Jane Andrews, the corporate nutritionist for the Wegmans grocery chain, which is one of the retail outlets that is being targeted in a campaign to label genetically engineered foods. Wegmans is tracking customer concern about GMOs as an emerging issue and discussing how they ought to respond. She said that Wegmans receives about 540 communications from customers each week. Until recently, they received only one inquiry each week of those 540 on the subject of GMOs. By comparison, bovine growth hormone in dairy products was a hot issue in 1994, and Wegmans received a total of 600 customer communications.
What are consumers thinking? What are their concerns and why? Is it more of an environmental issue for them? Is it more of a food safety issue for them? Is it all of the above? And certainly we're trying to look at the human health, food safety, and environmental studies as they come about. A year ago, I was in London and was really impressed by the strength of the passion of folks there, and also became aware of how much controversy there is about what is GMO. They're fighting. If you think that they've outlawed GMOs, they're fighting it. And some retailers are saying, well, you know, if the soybean oil or the corn syrup no longer has any DNA, that must be free of genetic modification. And then other people are saying, no, if it's from corn that was genetically modified, it's then GMO. So they're having lots of difficulty deciding how they will label this. And that difficulty is also very apparent here in the United States as regulators are trying to come up with the standards. And even the tolerance. In Europe, it's 1%. In Japan, it's 5% is acceptable and still call it GM-free. Here's an example of a label from the Netherlands. And again, this is just one of my counterparts who works in Holland showed me a label, and I'm trying to interpret what I thought it was in English. But at any rate, there was asterisks by each of the ingredients, like thiamine, riboflavin, soybean oil, cottonseed oil, and saying that it may include genetically modified product. When we're talking about labeling in Europe, this is kind of what we're talking about. Just so you know, I mean, I was amazed. Oh, that's what it is. And consumers there had in the Netherlands had no problem with this kind of labeling. It didn't affect their buying decision at all. And certainly, I don't have any problem with this. I just want the rules to be clear. I want FDA to decide what the rules are, and then we'll follow it. So, if you got anything from my talk, GMO maybe is almost everything. GMO free, who knows? Who knows? And some people say, well, can't you just test? Just do a test, and you'll know. Consumer Reports went and did a test, and they showed these corn chips had genetic modified corn in it. Well, there is a company called Genetic ID. There's many companies that are actually testing to find that DNA, that certain strand that shows that it's been genetically modified, and kind of like O.J. Simpson. It takes days. You watch those trials. You know it doesn't come back in a moment. So they've got to check. It's hundreds of dollars every time one of these tests is done. So you can see that it's not something simple for us. There's another company that we've met with a couple of times, wonderful company called Strategic Diagnostics. Now, they've done a much simpler test. This is an immunoassay test. It's dipstick technology, about $5 per test, reliable, qualitative, but it doesn't work with processed foods. And there are no tests, nothing that will test for corn oil, for soybean oil, for corn syrup. Neither of these companies or anybody can look at that can of pop and tell whether or not it was genetically modified or from GM corn. I can tell you, I'm pretty sure it was, just because I know the food system, but there's no test that can tell you that. So that makes it kind of difficult for us when we talk about labeling. Should we or should we not label? We had a meeting with our executives, went over a bunch of things with them. And we looked at the options, and let me just, it's in your packet. We looked at options and thought, well, we could take, I mean, I had this idea when I was in London. I thought, well, why don't we just take our Food You Feel Good About line and make it GMO-free? Well, what I found out after studying is, there's not a test that I can do. I got 540 different suppliers. They don't know what their products are. They're often buying from somebody else. There's not a separate pipeline except for organic. And if I buy organic, I'm going to pay a heck of a lot more. And I don't think my customers are going to pay me for that. So we need a certifiable paper trail. That's not yet in existence. It would take us years to implement if we demanded it from our suppliers, but it would cost us a lot. We're not sure our customers will pay for it. We could promote organic. When I presented this option to our folks at the executives, they said, hey, wait a minute. The produce department guy said, now, wait a minute. That'd make it seem like the rest of the produce in my department is GM. It's not. He was right. So we thought, well, when a customer asks or when we write a column for Mary Ellen, we'll talk about this and say that if you're concerned, you can buy certified organic. But otherwise, everything in the produce department is fine. Our decision at this point regarding GMOs is to continue to read, listen, learn, and as with other products, we'll wait and let the marketplace try to take the leadership on this, see what happens, see what customers want, what they tell us is what we'll do, and educate as much as we can. That's why I'm here. So thank you.
That was Jane Andrews, corporate nutritionist for Wegmans Grocery Stores, speaking at a symposium on biotechnology and food safety held in Syracuse last month.
Let me briefly introduce our next two speakers. They will be co-presenting together. This is Lou and Murby Lego, and they are the co-owners of Elderberry Pond Farm. They're full-time fresh market growers of fruits and vegetables. The farm uses organic growing techniques and the latest in integrated pest management practices to ensure the safety of those working on the farm and those buying their produce. Lou is a graduate of Penn State University with an engineering degree and a master's in business administration from Syracuse University, and he was employed for 25 years at General Electric as a research engineer. And he's been a fresh market grower for that same period. He retired 2 years ago and has since been working with some research grants from Cornell, as well as an additional grant to carry out integrated pest management projects to reduce the uses of pesticides. Lou has experimented with many new fruits and vegetables on his farm. He currently grows over 100 varieties of apples, including, and I never heard of these before I heard him speak in November, the rare heirloom and the English cider varieties. He's also many plantings of unusual ethnic vegetables and fruits, including one of the state's first Asian pear orchards. Murby, his wife, is a registered dietitian and a graduate of Penn State with a degree in hospital dietetics and University of Iowa with a master's degree in nutrition. She's worked as a research dietitian in the past in the University of Iowa Hospitals, as well as Abington Memorial Hospital in Pennsylvania and Luke's Memorial Hospital in Utica. For the past 15 years, she's worked part-time and now full-time at Elderberry Pond Country Food Store. In addition to the country food store, the Legos market their produce through the area's farmers market and through a farm subscription program, which some of us know as a CSA, or Community Supported Agriculture.
We're going to talk about some choices that farmers have in terms of GMOs. Why would we be interested in using them, or why might not we be interested in using them? And then Murby is going to talk about consumers and what as a consumer you should expect, what information you should expect when you buy directly from a farmer. Should he be able to tell you whether they're GMOs or not, and what other questions might you ask when you do that? So we've sort of split it up in that way. First, direct market farms are, as the name implies, don't sell to anybody that sells to anybody else. Every customer we have in all of our business is someone who comes back to the farm or who we know personally. And so we feel very strongly that we have a responsibility to these people. These are people we know. We've dealt with them for years. They're not going to come back if we mess up. It's not like us selling to someone and where it goes, who knows. It's gone and out of our barn and someone has it, and if they don't like it, we probably won't hear about it. So these farms tend to be small. Between 10 and 50 acres is probably typical. Not a lot of machinery because you can't afford it at that. Another characteristic of them is that they tend to grow a large variety of crops. Most of the crops in this country today are grown on very highly specialized farms. I was reading the other day that we have a magazine that we get the list of biggest farms in the country. And most of them are in California, fruit and vegetable farms. Most of them are in California. There's 50, 60,000 acres with one crop. One of them's so-and-so brothers in Salina Valley, California, 60,000 acres of lettuce. Every year, lettuce on the same land, 60,000 acres of it planted, cut, sent somewhere. That guy doesn't have a lot of people coming to him saying, you know, lettuce wasn't very good last week. It's kind of a different scheme of farming. In our business, taste and the freshness is the only discriminator we have. We're competing with Wegmans, which have beautiful produce all year. And the only reason we're going to get business, we're going to get business on cost. Our cost is not much better, if it's better at all, than Wegmans. So it's got to be fresher, and it's got to taste better, or we're not going to get the business. And as was mentioned, we sell through three ways, in our store and through a CSA and also in farmers markets. All of these aspects, as I'm going to explain, of direct marketing don't favor small farms and R-sized farms using GMOs for reasons that talk about. A big problem in sweet corn all over the country, becoming a much bigger problem all the time, is European corn borer, which, if you read corn, has a little hole in the husk. Don't take that one. Find another one. Don't pick that one out. There's a European corn borer who's gotten in there and is enjoying the corn before you do. And another one is crops that aren't killed by Roundup. So you can plant corn, wait till the corn's up, see weeds all over the field, spray the field. The corn lives and the weeds die. So it's an amazing spectacle to see, and it's popular around the country as a way to grow corn. And crops with slowed down ripening, there are many varieties, not just Flavor Saver, but there are other tomatoes that have been modified to either ripen slow or have some other characteristic. And then disease resistance is probably the fastest growing, and particularly in cucurbits, in squash and melons, because disease, particularly up around Syracuse, is horrible. Powdery mildew, mosaic disease, all sorts of diseases that attack these crops. All of these features that are mentioned come with what I consider serious drawbacks. If you look at sweet corn and say, well, I want to buy a BT corn, and we get commercial catalogs with all the varieties, and the most common corn, BT corn, is attribute. The problem with it is, one, you have to plant 40 acres and you have to buy 100,000 seeds, in some places 10,000 seeds. So for some reason, it's been limited to super sweet corns in large quantities. So we couldn't buy it on our farm anyway unless we kept the seed for 20 years and planted a little bit every year, which we're not likely to do. And the other thing is, these particular varieties of super sweet corns are not ones you would pick to taste. They're not good, particularly good varieties. Super sweet corns were developed for one purpose. They can be grown in Florida, thrown on a truck, and the sugars don't convert on the way to New York. So when you see Florida corn this time of year, it's almost certainly super sweet, and it's almost certainly GMO corn. There's almost no chance that it isn't. And when you taste it, I don't particularly like it, but it's in the stores and it's better than what used to be because of the both conventional and other plant breeding that's been done to make it ship. The other thing is, these seeds are very expensive, and that when you take them and when you use them, there's something always associated with them. There's a string that's attached to planting and farming with these. You have to do this, you have to do that. You can't plant super sweet corns in cool soil, but we never get warm soil in New York, so that's a problem. They germinate very poorly. All these crops are not meant for small farms. They're meant for huge single crop farms where if you have 10,000 acres of straight neck squash and it gets a disease, you've got a problem. It spreads like wildfire through the field. We don't have 20,000 acres of squash. We have a couple of rows, you know, and we have 10 different varieties of squash in that row. They're not all going to get the same disease, and so it's not this kind of thing is not geared for small farms. It's not meant for small farms. And the most important thing, and this is something that you get as a farm for a while, is a farm like ours on a small farm has an incredibly complicated and interesting ecological balance. As you farm and as you farm organically for a few years, you start to realize that everything that you think might be out of your control, insect pests like corn borer, and weeds and diseases, are all part of a network. And as you get that farm into a balance, an ecological balance, all those things decline and go away. European corn borers, the eggs are eaten by Trichogramma wasps, which if you have enough good weed systems in your farm, not in the fields, hopefully, but around the farm, you will have beneficial insects that will take care of this pest. If you introduce something into that system, a GMO crop or insecticide or anything that's tailored to do one specific thing, you throw that balance off. And when you throw that balance off, you pay for that for years. So that balance, that is extremely important on a farm, on a direct farm kind of size farm. Taste and freshness are our discriminator. Almost all the plant breeding, both conventional and genetically engineered and genetically modified breeding, is done for things that we don't care about. Chipping quality, size and color. You just go into the store and look at the stuff that's in there. The peppers that look too big to be possible. And we had some grapes last week were as big as lemons. There are Thompson seedless grapes that, you know, people, wow, that's a big grape. I'm going to get some of those. Most of that stuff doesn't taste very good. The flavor isn't there, and we would have a hard time reselling that stuff. People come back because our stuff has extraordinary taste. So these things, at least so far in genetic engineering, have been tailored for crops. This is an interesting one here. This is a new tomato called Sunbeam. It's in Rogers' commercial catalog. You can't read the fine print on there, but what it says is that this tomato packs out well, it's firm, and it begins to ripen uniformly after it's gassed, whatever that means. And you probably don't want to know what that means. But these things are not grown in a field with people picking them and putting them in a basket. These things are picked dead green, put on a truck in a box, gassed somewhere, and then shipped. So it's a different thing than direct market farming. I mean, it's not what I think about as farming. Okay, with that, I'm going to turn it over to Murby. He's going to tell you when you go to a direct market farm, how can you interact with the farmer? How can you find out? There is some possibility that he'll have a GMO crop. How would you sort that out and figure it out?
When you are going to a farmer's market or a farm to buy produce, there are some questions that you can ask. This is if you're concerned about getting genetically engineered foods and if you want to avoid them. And we're just talking about fresh produce here. As you heard before, when you're dealing with foods that might have corn oil in them or soy products in them, that's another whole category. What I'm focusing on here is just fresh produce that you would go to buy. The first thing you should ask is, where was the produce grown? Just because you're buying it at a farmer's market from someone who looks like a farmer does not mean that he grew it. A lot of the farmer's markets, some of the farmer's markets fortunately have regulations that you have to grow. Very few of them actually say that you have to grow everything that you're selling. Most of them say you have to grow a certain percentage of what you're selling. Some of them, quite frankly, you don't have to grow anything that you're selling. So at some of the farmers' markets, you're basically dealing with a middleman person. So you be aware of that before you start asking questions. Did he grow it? And then you might want to ask what variety you're purchasing. If he doesn't know what variety it is, there's no way you're going to know if it was genetically modified. Is the variety a genetically modified type? The farmer may not know this, actually. Most of the seeds that we buy, well, we know that the ones we're buying are not genetically modified. But sometimes that isn't obvious from the seed catalogs. Sometimes you might have to actually call the seed company to find out. It takes a little research. We think that it's the responsibility of direct market farmers to find that out. But not every farmer might know that. The varieties that you might want to keep in mind, if you're asking him what variety it was, these are some of the things that you could potentially find at a farmer's market that might be genetically modified. The BT sweet corn, which has been mentioned several times, the super sweet varieties, attribute and yield guard are some that might pop up, the names. BT potatoes, new leaf, and you can get these in upstate New York, by the way. We actually got a shipment of these by mistake this year, so we know that they're sending them to upstate New York, some of these new leaf genetically engineered potatoes. Then some of the squashes also, the Independence 2 and the zucchini and Independence 3, and the yellow crookneck squash are sometimes genetically modified. Tomatoes, talked about that too. That's another one. And there, Flavor Saver and Endless Summer are the two varieties that would be genetically engineered.
First, GMO fruits currently, with the current state of breeding and everything, are not well suited to small farms. They're suited for another intention. They're suited for the produce distribution system that's been set up in this country, where you can grow things in California. Somebody in California can grow a cabbage, ship it 3,000 miles through three different distribution centers and sell it as cheaply as I can sell it, going out across the road and picking it. That distribution system is the way things are set up, and it's the reason that plant breeders are breeding plants. And the reason for that is because a lot of that research work comes from funding from large institutions. We're not funding much plant breeding at Elderberry Pond. So that's good and bad. I'm not saying that's all bad or all good, but it's the way it is. That distribution system is driving everything. We have, as direct market farmers, wonderful, very sustainable alternatives to all these things. We don't have cucurbit diseases on our farm. We have traps for European corn borers that work perfectly. And we don't have any of the problems that all these things address. And we won't have them because our farm is being sustained in an ecological way, and it will be that way for the next 300 years. Nothing is going to change that. It's a stable ecological environment, and so we don't need these things. And the final point is that you should question farmers. It's a good thing. It'll be a good thing for farmers. I like it when people in the farmer's market come up and say, one lady last fall came up and said, are your apples genetically modified? And I had to think about it. I'm thinking, well, they were somewhere along the line they were genetically modified. I mean, it all started with one apple, and I'm running all these things through my mind of how to answer this poor woman. And I don't think I just babbled on like I am now, and I don't think she ever got an answer. But I know it's not what we call a GMO in this room, those apples. And finally, buying from direct market growers and processors gives you, we think, the best assurance of knowing what you're getting. You're getting it from us, and you're going to be back to us, and we feel a responsibility to you. And we'll answer any question you have, what pesticides we use, what herbicides, any question you have, we can answer. It's not third hand through who knows where that product came from.
That was Lou and Murphy Lego, owners of a direct market organic farm in Auburn, New York.
The final speaker at the Symposium on Biotechnology and Food, held last month in Syracuse, was Tony Del Plato, a member of the Moosewood Restaurant Collective, chef, gardener, homemaker, and activist, and coordinator of the Ithaca Area Safe Food Campaign, a consumer advocacy group which has been active on the issue of genetically modified foods.
I just want to say a disclaimer right off the bat. I'm not here representing Moosewood Restaurant because many people at Moosewood are not sure, just as I think many of you are not sure. And so many individuals at Moosewood support much of the work I'm doing and understand many of the issues. But as a business, as a whole, Moosewood has not taken a stand on this. And it's probably from a business point of view, a prudent decision. I've been studying, reading about GMOs for about 2 years now, and it's incredible how much information there is. But I'd like to say that I've met Margaret Smith a number of times. She's a neighbor of mine, and someone like Margaret and other researchers and scientists I've met have helped to ground me to better understand the issues. I'm still a little suspicious of anyone who says they're on the fence on the issue, because I'm off the fence. I've taken a position in light of the biotech blitzkrieg, and I use this word very seriously because I think language is an important issue here. In light of the biotech blitzkrieg of hype and products, what are the issues that we face as producers and consumers of transgenic food products? Well, there's four primary issues at this point. Language, we consume, but do we know who produces? Taking back our government, patents. I think those are some of the critical issues. And while a science may be on the fence, or I think in all honesty, most people are saying we really don't know the long-term effects. And so let the research continue. One of the big questions we have to face as consumers is what interventions have taken place between the seeds in our mouths? And like the Legos who spoke before us, when you are close to the farmer, you know where the food is coming from. There aren't too many questions, but even a farmer has to wonder where the seeds are coming from. What's the impact of all of this new technology on the farmer's ability to do business? And I think that pressure has been tremendous on American farmers as well as farmers all over the world. On American farmers, I think they're taking a beating now because of the international response to genetically engineered products. The American Corn Growers Association has come out and said that they do not support genetically engineered foods and seeds at this point. They didn't take a stand on whether GM foods are safe or not, but in the interest of their farmers, and I think having access to markets, they decided to take that position. The British Medical Association has supported a moratorium on these products. So I think that what we're consuming is a big question right now. And Jane Andrews spoke about being consumer-driven, and I think that that's an important thing for anyone in business. But as a consumer, both a homemaker and a professional, I have to try to put together the whole picture as best I can, both as a citizen and as one who consumed. I don't like being called a consumer. We all consume, but being a consumer means that, well, you know, you're part of the marketing campaign. And so if there's consumers and producers, my own point of view is I consume what I need as little as possible. I consume in a way that's conscious of its impact all around me. Taking back our government. One of the biggest problems that I think has occurred in this whole debate is that during the Bush Quayle administration in the 80s, Vice President Quayle pretty much was leading the charge in a deregulatory process and pretty much made the Food and Drug Administration break its own rules by creating the idea of substantial equivalence. Now, that's not a scientific term, as Margaret Smith explained to me at one point. It's language. It's a concept. It's an idea. But by creating this idea of substantial equivalence, it meant that genetically modified foods didn't need to be labeled, which the FDA had always labeled in the past. Substantial equivalence. We know what equivalent means, but substantial. Now, there's the tricky word. Michael Pollan wrote in the New York Times in October 1998, Playing God in the Garden. And I think this statement will pretty much clarify why I believe we need to take back our government. In 1998, the New York Times reported that regulation of the pesticidal potato has fallen through the cracks of U.S. government. The FDA told the Times it did not regulate the potato because it does not have the authority to regulate pesticides. That responsibility, said the FDA, lies with the Environmental Protection Agency. But the EPA said labeling pesticidal products, potatoes, is FDA's job because potatoes are a food. The FDA responded that the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act forbids the food agency from including information about pesticides on food. And so it goes. Meanwhile, Phil Angel, Monsanto's director of corporate communication, told the Times in that same article that Monsanto should not have to vouchsafe the safety of biotech food. Our interest is in selling as much as possible. Assuring its safety is the FDA's job. So what we have here is a lot of double talk. And I started thinking, well, this round and round, what's it, what could this all be about? I mean, substantial equivalence, I think, is the basis upon which the promotion of genetically engineered foods has moved forward. I don't believe it's substantial equivalent. I think it's significantly different. But I think people will argue here. I think the safety, the potential benefits still have a long way to go in terms of research. But we have, as everyone has said, a long way to go to determine some of the answers to these questions. We need our government to monitor independent research. Right now, the USDA is vested in things like terminated technology and supporting agricultural, developing agricultural markets in other parts of the world. USDA is not spending enough time in supporting family farmers, small farmers. They're interested in the big guys. Now we have to say, well, why is this so? I think the biggest problem we have is that in America, we have the best democracy money can buy. And what we see is a revolving door policy between industry, the FDA, and research centers. Now, I don't mean to blanket everybody in each of these agencies. I know that there are people within research institutions, within business, within government, who are trying to do the right thing. The EPA and USDA, it's been revealed, have actually suppressed and marginalized scientists who raised questions in the early years. So from my point of view, we need a moratorium on the production of GE products for commercial markets. As I said, the British Medical Association supports that worldwide moratorium, and there's a growing movement in this country. New York State has legislation on both the State Assembly and the State Senate. The next issue is patents. Who owns genes and seeds? That's becoming an incredibly critical problem. Can you really own a seed? Can you actually own a living thing that has always been part of our history, our culture? Industry will say, well, we need a way to benefit from our inventions. But they really haven't invented anything. There may be a whole range of discussions about exactly what's been done, chemically separating a gene and blasting it into cell and creating a whole new organism. But inventions, who invented the gene or the chromosomal structure? Again, the idea of substantial equivalence seems to support that idea. I want to give you just one example of a reversal on a patent. W.R. Grace, a multinational agribusiness corporation, attempted to patent the neem tree. It's a tree from India, and it has many, many, many values. As it turns out, all of these patent requests were being made, and the European Union had pretty much taken the patent back, which they had received years before. And so we're seeing more and more questions being raised as to really who owns all of these things. Now, with these issues out there, you know, what do we do? I think there's a number of things we need to do. One is we face our fears. But facing our fears, what fears do we have? There's uncertainty. Do we know enough about genes and transgenic processes? Do we know enough about human physiology, nutrition, to commercialize all of these products? I don't think so. Stop commercialization is another thing I think we need to do. One way you can do that is by supporting organic. Now, obviously, organic foods are much more expensive than other foods because right now, organics make up about 1% of the market in produce sold. But I believe that once organic agriculture really takes off and becomes more available, like anything else, the more supply, the more the prices come down. Challenging the myths. That's a big one, and I think that that's where the industry as a whole is trying to go the same route as nuclear power. Too cheap to meter. No problems with that. And so facing our fears, stopping commercialization, and challenging myth is what I'm trying to do.
That was Tony Del Plato of the Ithaca Area Safe Food Campaign speaking at a symposium on genetic engineering and food safety, presented by the Cornell Cooperative Extension of Onondaga County late last month. More information about the Cooperative Extension programs and the speakers in the symposium will be posted on the Unwelcome Guests website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. You're tuned to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva and WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. We'll conclude with highlights of the question period from the symposium on biotechnology and food.
Margaret, the first question is about Roundup Ready technology. Why Roundup Ready, or why is this used?
It's a good question, and recall that one of the points I tried to make was we need to think about these things on a case-by-case basis. One of the products that has been developed, and I'm not even sure which industry has developed it, is Roundup Ready wheat. Now, it's not being marketed yet, so it's not out there. But even if you talk to farmers, they look at you and say, Roundup Ready wheat? Why? We don't have a weed control problem in wheat. Who is going to pay extra money for that? On the other hand, in the world of soybeans, controlling weeds is actually very, very difficult. And I think that's why in the data that we saw earlier, you saw such high levels of acceptance of Roundup Ready soybeans. It really makes farmers' lives much simpler. So, back to my message, think about these things on a case-by-case basis. The other thing I would add, and I was thinking about this as Tony was speaking, if you look at Roundup Ready soybeans, yes, there's more Roundup being used on Roundup Ready soybeans. There's less of other herbicides, and some of those other herbicides that are being used less extensively are, in fact, much more environmentally risky. For consumers, is there a benefit here? Only a very indirect one in the sense of perhaps some environmental pluses. But I think when people who are not farmers or not in the industry ask why Roundup Ready, from their point of view, there's not a whole lot of compelling reason.
Another question from Margaret. Isn't it true that the process of inserting genes into other organisms is not very exact on the predictable process, and that where it lands in the DNA strand has a huge effect on the conveyed traits?
I think that's a good point to make. I mentioned that there's precision in the sense of what gene you're adding, but where it will integrate, there is not control over at this point. If that gene lands in the middle of some other gene that's particularly important and causes that to no longer be expressed, then you have a problem. So I think that's why it's very important that testing be done on the products of genetic engineering, field testing to make sure about their performance, and safety testing. So yes, there is imprecision in where that gene lands. It has the potential to disrupt the genetic function of an organism, and that's why testing is critical.
Here's one for Dorothy. IGF-1 has been shown to increase the risk of which cancers?
I know it's breast cancer. There's probably more.
Another question for Dorothy. Wouldn't the average person have to consume an exorbitant amount of genetically modified foods to affect the resistance to antibiotics?
We need, as a society, to be making our decisions for the weakest, because they too need to be supported. And our weakest people may be children, it may be people with compromised immune systems, and so we need to make those decisions in line of those people, not the majority.
Question for Jane. You implied that organic products are GM-free. From previous speakers and literature, these are not related. Please clarify.
We've gone through a process over the past 5 years of developing organic standards. A lot of work, a lot of debate, an argument from what USDA thought organic standards should be. USDA first came out and said GM seeds should be allowed, right? Remember that? Anybody? And many farmers who were planting organic or growing organic were like, oh, no, they're not, and screamed bloody murder. As we finally have seen the finalization of those rules, agree or disagree, I think that I'm trying to state that fairly. I am very comfortable with saying that no organic farmer is planting genetically modified seeds. And so, in fact, the new rules that are not yet law, but they will be law, say that you cannot plant genetically modified seeds and call it certified organic.
It is a rule in the new standard that you may not plant any GMO crops. There have been some accidents, however. There's a farmer in Penyam who sold a lot of soybeans to Europe, organic farm, a very, very rigid, good organic farm. They tested it in Europe, and it was GMO, sent the stuff back. Farmer there says the seed was contaminated, and she had no idea. They bought it as organic soybeans.
As long as you still have the mic, another question for you is, how concerned are you about genetic pollution from genetically engineered crops?
We have a neighbor who came over to me and said he planted 100 acres of BT corn. And I said, well, geez, where is it? You know, I'm thinking I had planted corn. Well, it turns out it's way far away. But how far is far? 8 miles is considered the distance that pollen will travel from between cornfields. This is a real problem, and one of the big remaining debates in the National Organic Standards is who should be responsible, the organic farm or the conventional farm, and there's no real clear answer to that.
There's a comment from one individual in the audience for Jane. Just as I, a consumer at Wegmans, am demanding that you label all foods containing GM ingredients, you should be demanding that your suppliers inform you as to what GM foods they are selling to Wegmans. It's been done in Europe. You can do it here.
Retailers in Europe were not getting one call a week. They were getting thousands of calls a week. About 50% of the consumers wanted labeling. And so the whole system there has agreed to this precautionary principle. And, you know, we're not going to bring it in until it's more until it's tested. So even the boats that come in are tested. In Britain, they have a controlled supply. They have a very strong consumer who says they don't want it. This consumer has spoken that they're willing to pay more not to have this. I haven't gotten that sense from our consumers yet. When we've talked to our suppliers, even though I know that Archer Daniels Midland can segregate, they're telling us they're not segregating unless we want to buy organic. It would increase the price of goods. So I understand that individuals want this, and I certainly respect your interest. But I'm not, I can't support three separate pipelines. Certified organic is a very viable, well-controlled, there's a system all the way along to be sure that contamination does not occur. We're going to say certified organic is how you assure that you do not get genetically modified foods.
There have been a couple of studies about Americans and their response to all of this, and 55% of the American people did not know, do not know now that these products are in the market. When people were asked whether they wanted labeling, Time Magazine, New York Times, a whole range of what we would consider standard, reputable organizations, 80 to 90% of the American people said they would, they do want labeling on genetically modified foods. About 60% of those said they probably would not buy those foods. And we may be at a crossroads. Do we want to have a worldview that supports the chemical industry and the war on nature, which is what I see, or as the Legos have attempted to be part of a system where there's balances? And I think that's the juncture we're at right now. And it's not just food, but food may be the mother of all economic activity.
So saith life, the world is mine, the flowers that bloom, and the song of the birds. I am the daylight, and the sunshine.
So spread this labor, the wealth is mine.
So saith death, the world is mine. I've made a tomb for all mankind. I have created pestilence and war.
So spread death's heart, the wealth is mine.
So saith life, the world is mine. For every grave is a plot of land into which my eternal seed.
So spread das Leben, die Welt ist mein.
Dr. Vandana Shiva spoke on biodiversity and the fight against intellectual property rights for biotech corporations last March at the University of San Francisco. She is introduced by USF Professor of Philosophy Eduardo Medieta.
Dr. Shiva was trained as a physicist. In 1982, she founded an independent institute, the Research Foundation for Science, Technology, and Ecology in DERA, in close cooperation with local communities and social movements. In 1991, she founded NAVDAYA, a national movement to protect the diversity and integrity of living resources, especially native seeds. NAVDAYA sets up community seed banks, supports conversion to organic agriculture, and establishing direct producer-consumer links for food security and food safety. Navdaya has also helped establish ARICE, a national alliance for organic agriculture, which is the most broad-based and dynamic network to promote sustainable agriculture. Dr. Shiva has contributed in fundamental ways to changing the practices and paradigms of agriculture and food. Her books, The Violence of the Green Revolution, Monocultures of the Mind, Biopiracy, and Stolen Harvest have become basic challenges to the dominant paradigms of non-sustainable reductionist green revolution agriculture. We're extremely proud to welcome Dr. Shiva.
I'd like to thank Eduardo for those extremely generous words, and also the university for organizing this evening and giving me an opportunity to also meet some very dear and very old friends. When I was asked to come and give a talk on biopiracy, around that time, I had received in the mail this amazing package. It says, Holding the Earth. And one would imagine it's an environmental group. I don't know if any of you recognize a shade of a logo. It's Monsanto. And they ask you to pull open the string. And it's amazing because it's 50 years in agriculture. One would, by reading it, think that if Monsanto hadn't been around selling herbicides, there'd have been no food in India. But the one I love is this page with a true story with a happy ending. And there are two sick farmers. And below them it says, chor, chor, thief, thief. And they're not talking about the farmers at that point. They would today if they were saving seed. They're talking about the biodiversity in the field, about mixed farming, about the greens that feed our rural people, our cows, our cattle, provide medicine. Our studies show that an ordinary small farm in India has at least 200 to 300 species, including those that are not planted, but are intended to be there, like the bathwa that grows with the wheat. My grandmother used to cook wonderful bathwa ka saag. It's the richest source of iron and vitamin A. The little Philanthus niruri, called the Jara Amla, major cure for jaundice. The bathwa was declared a thief by Monsanto. And they then go on in the next page talking about the brilliant ways in which they have actually helped an environmental revolution in India. On Roundup, more than a herbicide, it represents a movement that has changed cultivation forever. A broad-spectrum herbicide for sustainable development in line with environmental-friendly technologies. Roundup is marketed now in India in a very aggressive way as conservation tillage. Now, if I hadn't worked with the small-scale farms where at every point in every season you have cover crops, where we have rains that come in 3 months, 4,000 millimeters, 3,000 millimeters, strong summer sun, 50 degrees, if you really followed the Monsanto prescription of having rows of soybean or corn with herbicide resistance built into them, Roundup being sprayed to wipe out everything, it's not going to conserve the soil. It's just the opposite of conservation tillage. It's an erosion package. It's an erosion of biodiversity, the deliberate extinction of the plants that people need to feed themselves. It's a deliberate creation of erosion of soil and water capital. And yet, because of this amazing magic of the way mathematics has worked in agriculture, we're all made to believe that each time we destroy our food sources, we are producing more food. One reason I've stayed busy with looking at agriculture for the last 16 years now, starting with 1984, when this region of Punjab, which should have, you know, where those two people are from, two sick farmers, it was supposed to have benefited from the Green Revolution. It was the place for the miracle. The Green Revolution was introduced as an alternative to the Red Revolution that was happening in China. All the money had to move to prevent India going the China way. And in spite of those millions being poured by the World Bank for subsidies for chemicals, millions being poured by the Rockefeller Foundation, in the late 70s, early 80s, Punjab was up in arms with discontent, frustration, basically talking about being ripped off by an agricultural system that was leaving them poorer, by making them dependent on inputs that they didn't produce, on prices they didn't have any influence on. And in 1984, you might remember the Golden Temple was attacked by the Indian military. But the Golden Temple attack was not about a religious conflict. It was about a development conflict. It was about the pattern of agriculture and agricultural development. Because the Indian farmers that day were going to blockade the flow of grain to Delhi because they had been pushed into this economy of debt. I worked on the Green Revolution because it was very frustrating for me to see the whole discussion and debate on agriculture that the people of Punjab had raised disappear. And the whole issue turned into an issue of conflict between religions. It was not. Very often, if there were deaths, if there were attacks, it would be sick youth killing sick heads of agencies. The manager of the Bhakra Dam, called the Temple of Modern India. The head of the seed farm in Ludhiana, another sick. It wasn't an inter-religious conflict. It wasn't anything to do with Hindu-Sikh tensions. It had everything to do with a centralized agricultural system that in the name of producing more food, bringing more prosperity for farmers, was actually leaving farmers deeper in debt. I made my most recent trip to Punjab about 2 months ago to a region called Bhatinda, very, very prosperous region it used to be. Today, every village is deeply indebted. The farmers are not working on their land anymore. You find farmers on the streets of the cities asking for daily wage work to carry cement on their heads. And by more often than not, they don't get the work because they're anyway laborers with whom they're having to compete. Every village I visited had had one or two suicides. And this is just one other area, Warangal in Andhra Pradesh, more than 500 suicides in the last 2 years. Yotmal, Maharashtra, also suicides. Why has it got aggravated in the last few years? Because in addition to all the burdens, environmental burdens, financial burdens that were put on the farmers, in the last few years, because of trade liberalization, because of the new economic policy of 1991, triggered by the conditionalities of the World Bank and IMF, and more recently the free trade rules imposed by the World Trade Organization, we basically have a free market in seeds, pesticides, chemicals, lending. The World Bank said in 1965, let seed be supplied by the centralized national institutions that got their material from the centralized CG system. Iri for rice, the Simit for corn and wheat. In 1991, the same World Bank says, why is the government running seed farms? Close them up. It's such a waste of scarce budgetary resources. Let seed be supplied by the private corporations. The same World Bank that in 65 had given loans to India, increasing our debt threefold in 1 year, was now saying, why on earth is the government giving subsidies for chemicals? Let the companies finance all this. The same World Bank that had spread a network of credit in rural areas so that farmers could borrow to be able at low interest to be able to have the money to buy the diesel, to buy the chemicals, to buy the inputs, were now
being wrapped up under World Bank conditionalities. So you have the private corporations enter at a time when the entire system that has been created is dismantled overnight. It's like through the chemical agriculture, farmers are put on crutches. They're made dependent. And instantaneously, rather than let the person who's been walking with crutches remember how to walk again through ecological internal input farming, which is very doable. You give farmers 2 years, they will convert. But you pull the crutches instantaneously, the farmers fall. And that is what the real intention about these very brutal structural adjustment reforms are, to let the small producers fall and allow agriculture to move into the hands of global agribusiness. The seed companies are bringing in hybrid seed, half a kilo, 450 rupees, 1,000 rupees. In the case of tomato seeds, 20,000 rupees a kilo. The hybrid seeds never have an instruction saying this seed can't be saved. So farmers are saving the seed and having serious crop failure. They're also having huge crop failure because of very high pest vulnerability. So they go and buy large quantities of pesticides. And since they don't have the money, who pays for it? The credit comes from the same agencies that provide the seed and the chemicals. So you have the money lender, chemical agent, seed supplier, all in one, and the extension agent rolled in. And how do they do extension programs? With mythological videos. Videos of Hanuman, the monkey god, bringing down hybrid cotton seeds. Yeah? Or Guru Nanak, the Sikh god, selling Roundup. I mean, with a culture as pluralistic, as diverse, where we believe in Tis Karor Devta, 300 million gods. And that's about the species diversity assessment. And, you know, in the Indian thinking, there are 300 million gods around. Every leaf, every boulder, every tree is an embodiment of the divine. Can you imagine how many marketing agents are available for free in that tremendous culture? I've talked to farmers in regions where suicides started, and I said, why did you buy that seed? They said, the video was so good. Now, you know, it isn't Indian farmers alone who go after the videos. After all, that's how all the consumerism in this society works. You know, videos are very convincing. Ads are extremely powerful in creating need and creating response. Once you've sold the hybrid seeds, once you've sold the herbicides, you start getting scarcity. And that creation of scarcity is really the place for growth. If we did not have scarcity of seed, we would not have a market in seed. If every farmer was saving seed every year, where would you have a seed market? You would have seed abundance, but no seed market. So you have to create seed scarcity. You have to engineer seed so that it is sterile, so that farmers are forced to come back. You have to create hybrids so that farmers are forced to come back to buy seed every year. And if you're a chemical company that has bought up seed companies, which is the case for most biotech companies, they were basically chemical companies which expanded in the 80s to take over seed companies, and are basically finding very, very efficient ways to hook their chemical sales to their seed sales. 87% of biotech applications are herbicide-resistant crops. That's also the kind of acreage under GE crops. Now, herbicide-resistant crops do not increase food production. They decrease food production. We're privileged to have with us Miguel Altieri from Berkeley, and Miguel and Peter have also done studies that show that small farms are far more productive. The only thing is, if you have a monoculture of the mind and you look only at one output, then quite clearly, no matter how impoverished your ecosystem and no matter how low your productivity, if you're looking only for rice, if you're looking only for wheat, if you're looking only for corn and you have wiped out the remaining diversity, you will have more corn. You will have more rice. Punjab, you will of course have 100% increase in rice just by growing rice there, because there was no rice before the Green Revolution. And having wiped out all the tremendous diversity of Bathwa and Methi and Amaranth in the fields, you can then put vitamin A into rice through genetic engineering and say you have created vitamin A for the first time to solve the blindness problem. And anyone now interfering in genetic engineering is actually wanting to keep third world children blind. That is the latest response, the golden rice. And in terms of how much they had to market this as a miracle solution, in order, and they said very clearly, now finally we'll be able to get the biotech debate off the Frankenfood discussion. But there is no guarantee that the vitamin A in rice will be safe like the vitamin A in the greens, or in our mangoes, or in our papaya, or in our drumstick. Because one thing that has now been established by all the research that has been done on biotech crops and biotech foods is that very false assumption that was put into the U.S. regulatory system of substantial equivalence, that genetically engineered crops are identical to their natural counterparts, does not hold. The BT in the bacteria is very different from the BT in the plants. That is why, even though the natural BT does not go around killing monarch butterflies, BT corn, pollen does. Ordinary cotton does not kill ladybird beetles, but BT crops do. And this change in the structure of the physiology of the plant, the biochemistry of your plants, is part of what that modification is about. And yet, this call for sound science basically says, practice unsound science. Don't look at the novelty of how the organism is behaving once you have added novel genes to it. You can patent it, but that's what Eduardo was pointing out. You stop the claim to novelty after the claim to patenting. The rest of the process is natural, like nature made it, exactly like nature made it. And why on earth should you worry about cabbage with scorpion genes in it, which was Dr. Bishop's research in Oxford, or all the work by Zeneca on genes from rats and spider poisons? And since the genetic engineers, when they're thinking of engineering plants to produce their own pesticide, they forget that that plant is also supposed to be a food, not just for humans, but for the entire food chain, for the entire web of life. They're only thinking of that one pest that needs to be knocked out with the most toxic chemical that you can build into plants. But that's exactly what the thinking was behind pesticides. And pesticides did not solve the pest problem. It created a pest problem. We now have analysis of pest occurrence in indigenous crop varieties and pest occurrence in introduced crop varieties. Pest occurrence after pesticide use and pest occurrence before pesticide use, including the BT crop trials that Monsanto carried out in India. There was more pesticide use in the cotton, which was engineered to kill pests. There's also evidence of the absolutely confirmed emergence of resistance. These strategies are strategies to destroy biodiversity we need for ecological purposes, for human needs, for food for all species, to convert it into a thief and wipe it out. That is why Monsanto says biodiversity is a thief. And Cargill said exactly the same thing in 1992 when the Indian farmers tore down the Cargill. They said seed production plant, you know, these plants don't produce seed. Seed is produced in the field. They package the seed there. They don't produce seed there. They just put it into a sack and put a stamp. And after that very intense debate, the chief of Cargill India, his name was John Hamilton, said, Indian farmers are so stupid, they don't realize we have smart technologies that prevent the bees from usurping the pollen. And of course, farmers who do what they should be doing, which is saving seed, are pirates under the new intellectual property rights systems. And as if it was just seed and biodiversity and plants where this was working, the latest is privatization of water, being propelled on the one side by the World Bank requiring privatization, and on the other side by the World Trade Organization wanting to define free trade in water as a free trade in an environmental service. And just before I was leaving, I got this message from Harash that in a tribal area, Coca-Cola now owns the local lake. And owning the local lake, it is preventing tribals from having access to the water that their ancestors have helped harvest. So whether it is seeds or water, whether it is bees or biodiversity or farmers, what we are basically in is a new world structure where all life forms are being defined as potential thieves because they're interfering in the growth of markets for the life sciences corporations. The only problem is, if we left Monsanto, if we left it to Monsanto, Syngenta, to carry out all the pollination that is required in the world, carry out all the water conservation that's required in the world, to carry out all the amazing, endless work that nature performs with the diverse species, you can imagine how soon we'd have major ecological crisis and food crisis. Because even though they do like to think that they can wipe out every small farmer, you know, no matter how much high tech they have and how many satellites there are telling you the status of the soil moisture in your soil, if you don't have farmers working on that land, where more often than not those satellites are going to give you wrong information. They might interpret toxic spills as good irrigation. And I definitely know that in terms of forest assessments, they go totally wrong. They sometimes, in India, the satellite imagery declared Orissa as 100% forested because it was 100% green. And the infrared imagery from the paddy cultivation and the forest, they couldn't really distinguish. But the most important point is we now know enough about the mythology of the high productivity of monoculture industrial systems. These are impoverished systems. They cannot feed the world. They are systems that starve species. They kill the soil organisms. One of the experiments we do with farmers when we are encouraging them to convert is, you know, just take the urea that is applied in huge quantities on soils. Get earthworms and sprinkle urea on them. They die right in front of you. After a farmer has seen that happen in front of her eyes or his eyes, they will never, ever touch these synthetic fertilizers again. Because while the chemicals and the genetically engineered crops feed the profits, they do not feed the soil. They do not feed the species. And they do not feed the large majority of poor. Very often people feel that just because in the richer countries the supermarkets are more loaded than ever before, there's surplus around the world. It's not true. It's possible to have huge stocks here of shrimp of every kind because every coastal system of every country is being converted into a shrimp farm so that cheap shrimp can arrive in Japan, Europe, and the United States. But every kilogram of shrimp that is arriving here is depriving local communities with thousands of kilograms of fish and food. Every acre of a shrimp farm is ruining and devastating permanently 200 acres of productive mangroves, of creeks, of coastal waters. Because 15 times more fish has to be caught at sea to feed the shrimp in the factory farms. And the factory farms, since they're stocked with saline water, have this seepage. And in Tamil Nadu, in Andhra Pradesh, in Orissa, the entire coastal area now has water scarcity because there's salt water and women are having to walk 10 miles, 20 miles, which is why they started actions. We built a movement. We had a Supreme Court case. We got the activity stopped. And yet, because we are in this deregulated environment, the shrimp trading interests financed by the World Bank are basically thinking they will undo the laws on the basis of which we closed the shrimp industry. And that, for the last 3 years, has been a big tug of war. Will they get away moving Parliament to change the laws, or will we use our Parliament to prevent the changing of those laws and deregulating the environment totally for free trade in shrimp? You might have heard of the recent cyclone in Orissa in November. It killed 35,000 people. I know it wasn't so much on the TVs of the world as was Mozambique and Madagascar and Hurricane Mitch before that. Part of it being there was massive domestic politics around that cyclone between the BJP and the Congress, but that's a separate story. We've just finished a study. The cyclone was twice the velocity of all cyclones in the past. It was 300 kilometers. The tidal wave came in 30 kilometers. Past memory, people say 1 kilometer, 2 kilometers, you get floodwaters coming in. It came in 30 kilometers. And the velocity was higher and was not reduced because in the regions where these shrimp farms have come up, the mangroves, which are the buffer, have been destroyed. Where the mangroves survived, the damage was much less. The figures from the Danish Environment Ministry are that for a kilogram of food moving around the world, 10 kilograms of CO2 is being pumped into the atmosphere. And all that CO2 is what is creating the climate change. And we live in such a scientific world that instead of recognizing climate change as an environmental catastrophe that is happening around us, all our climatologists are kept busy finding new names for these occurrences. It's El Nino and La Nina and Elena and, you know, it just goes on and on. El Nino was supposed to happen once in 7 years. Somewhere or the other, there's an El Nino every year. And this individual naming is part of the mystification so that people don't recognize that you cannot destroy food production systems and local economies everywhere and ship every grain of food eaten and every bit of water drunk around the world and expect the climate to stay absolutely stable. Climate change is just one of the externalities of a free trade, globalized industrial agriculture system that is creating absolute threats to the very survival of people. The figures for India are scary. We will, if nothing is done, as a result of the global CO2 accumulation, India is going to have, within the next 50 to 80 years, 50 million people dying along our coastal regions because of these kind of storms, 75% decline in precipitation and runoff, which means 75% increase to the existing water scarcity, which for Monsanto will be wonderful because they're saying, as water gets scarce, our sustainability analysis tells us that there's a sustainable market in water. That is their sustainability reason for wanting to enter private markets in water. In addition to all this is, of course, the attempt to not just own living resources that people need for survival, but to declare them an invention. You've heard of the case of basmati rice, rice that grows in our Dehradun Valley. RiceTech insists it invented basmati instantaneously. Even God took 7 days. And the claim then goes on to say, you know, it's the height of the plant, the length of the grain, the aroma. Basmati basically means aromatic rice. That's what the word means. They basically then say, and all these traits, no matter how they occur in anyone's plants, will be treated as an infringement. And there are enough legal cases in this country that have basically said that if a company has a patent on a plant trait, it doesn't matter how that patent came to be. It could be through traditional crops. It could be through farmers breeding. The existence of it will be treated as an infringement. It will be treated as piracy. That is the reason that there is so much pressure on India to change her intellectual property rights laws. From 1993, there have been 7 attempts to introduce plant variety monopolies, and to change our patent laws. So far, we have managed to stall it each time. Last November, the company started to get desperate, and GlaxoWelcome put pressure on Europe and the US to say, we want exclusive marketing rights based on patents we hold anywhere else in the world, because we have an AIDS drug we want to sell, but we will only sell it with an exclusive right to market. And we hope the courts will rule that this is absolutely against the constitutional rights of the Indian people to have access to medicine and access to health care and access to nutrition and access to seed. The other famous case, of course, is the case of Neem, where Grace has a large number of patents. And we have legal challenges in Europe. We could not challenge it in the U.S. because you cannot challenge patents in the U.S., even if you're the original innovators, if you don't have a commercial interest. You have to be able to prove, no, I wanted that U.S. market. And we weren't going to base our case on piracy, on saying the market for Neem in U.S. should actually have gone to Navdani and not to Grace. We had more than 100,000 people join up in that case. At least the European Patent Office has accepted it. 9th of May, we'll have our final hearing on that particular piracy. But the really interesting thing about the piracy issue is that even though it is now recognized not as an aberration, it is recognized as an epidemic that is systemic. It is a perversion of the system of intellectual property rights. It's a perversion of a system of patenting that actually makes the basic mistake of imagining that living resources, life forms, are inventions that can be owned as property. Because no matter how much brilliance you have in moving genes around, you're just a gene mover. You're not a life maker. It's like taking chairs from this hall and putting them in a building across the street, and there's no way the University of San Francisco could tell the owners of those houses that just because we moved a chair, we own your house, we made it. Never get away with it. We don't get away with it in real estate, but we get away with it on the very fabric of life. That moving genes is treated as making life. And then the right of exclusive life, right granted by through the patent system to exclude everyone else from making life, creates this amazing worldview where nature making life is treated as a pirate. Farmers working with nature to produce life are treated as pirates. And the pirates are protected by the world intellectual property rights system. Of course, it's not the first time this is happening. You know, the papal bull, you remember? The Pope just apologized for it. The papal bull was a protection of the pirates in that period, 1492. It was basically a legal system to protect the merchant adventurers and pirates and leave all the people of the world totally vulnerable to piracy. Except at that time, the god they worshipped was the Christian god. And today the god they worship is this amazingly fictitious creation of money on Wall Street. If you just put together the ads that come out in this, you know, in the world today, there are no people. There are no people with rights. There are, of course, no species. The only institution that has rights are the corporations. And the only entity that is creating life is capital. And that to capital in a totally disembodied, totally uprooted form. 70 to 80 times out of proportion with the goods and services on this planet. And the goods and services are actually shrinking as the ecological crisis shrinks our water, as Monsanto helps us wipe out our biodiversity on our farms. And that is why we have a double level response to this enclosure of life, the commons, knowledge, cultures, an enclosure of the future too. Because while we've had colonization before, while we've had globalization before, What is unique about the contemporary globalization is that it works with technological tools that do not just colonize nature and other cultures. It is colonizing the future itself. It is destroying the evolutionary potential through the contamination of the web of life, through genetic pollution, biopollution. That is why the debate on genetic engineering becomes deeper the more people hear about what's going on and what the consequences are. It's also a colonizing of the future in terms of how many people are being robbed of their right to survive and live on this planet with dignity. The most recent economics of indignity has been created through an agreement imposed on India during the period of the hijack of the IC-814, you know, that little aeroplane from Kathmandu landed in Afghanistan. And 24 hours, Indian TV was busy telling people what's happening with the hijacked plane. While we were busy watching the hijack, the U.S. had imposed on India a new agreement to remove all restrictions on every commodity. Most of it by March this year, the remaining by March next year. This is supposed to be free trade. And among the free trade items is 50 items of waste from slaughterhouses. You know, those highly mechanized, high-speed, large, giant slaughterhouses are already creating 83 million cases of serious food hazards and food scares in this country. And given that there is now this amazing technology to recycle everything into everything else, except back to the soil, you know, we have amazing technologies for rendering dead cattle and animal waste into cattle feed, which is why cows went mad in England. And from all the studies, there's lots of mad cow and mad pig disease in this country. It's just that it doesn't come out, because the food industry has managed to have state after state pass these laws that if you do honest science, if you have an honest awareness of the hazards of these systems, you are slandering food. Food slander laws, which have kept people quiet, which have scared activists and shut science up. You know, in India, we are a billion people. We have survived millennia. We have survived millennia by farming in ways that we leave enough room for other species, by farming in ways that most people can feed themselves. Today, that billion population is totally redundant except for the few people who went into software training. And then, of course, they come to this region, and sometimes, once in a while, they're paraded. I remember some software engineers who were working in the Air Force base were paraded for being illegal just because they weren't carrying their visas. You can't be in an Air Force base without a visa. I mean, if the U.S. reaches that stage, its entire intelligence system has totally collapsed. The billion Indians can survive only if other species survive. A billion Indians can survive only if small-scale agriculture allows them to feed themselves. And if there's dumping of wheat and rice and soya bean and milk, as is already happening with soya bean, 300% increase in imports, $1 billion spent of scarce foreign exchange, and the prices of all related commodities are just collapsing. We're constantly told that the reason the prices are getting lower is because there's higher productivity in agriculture. Absolutely false. Prices are collapsing because there's higher monopolies in agriculture. And the companies that sell the inputs are buying the commodities. And as they buy the commodities, they get farmers to compete each other down. They fix the prices. And that is why in US, in India, anywhere in the world, over the last 5 years, prices of agricultural crops have reduced to half. Meantime, what consumers are paying has increased 4- to 5-fold. So it's not that consumers get cheaper food, especially in the third world, you don't. But farmers get nothing, and they are getting into a negative economy. They're spending more on production than they're getting back. That very artificial system is wiping out small farmers, not because their activity was unproductive, but because the reflection of the value of their activity on a very false economic system is negative. Our campaigns to change this include the call that agriculture and food needs to come out of a free trade regime. Food is not about trade and profits alone. Food is about nourishment. Food is about our obligation to the earth. We have an amazing Upanishad. I never can really overcome my bewilderment to see an entire Upanishad dedicated to food, the Taittiriya Upanishad, which goes on and on about how feeding every species is the duty of humanity. Eating yourself is a byproduct of feeding others. And that is how we have managed to ensure food security, through sharing, through giving. That sharing and giving is today a criminal act under the rules of free trade. We have to reclaim our freedom to save seed, to share food, to give food. And we have to criminalize the activities that are criminalizing life itself. Getting food out of the WTO, getting biodiversity out of intellectual property rights, those are two minimal steps in which we need a worldwide movement of people, no matter where they work, whether they work with farmers and agriculture, whether they work in ethics, culture, traditions. They work on consumer rights. They work on human rights. No matter where you are, if you are living today, the obligation to the present and to the future requires engagement in these issues. We also have fun along the way. We have a campaign that sends out, you know, we have a campaign, a movement for reclaiming living democracy, not just for the human community, but for the earth community. And village after village, people are taking a pledge. More than 3,500 villages in India have already formed their biodiversity republics called Jaiv Panchayat. And through that, they basically say, all the diverse life forms are our brothers and sisters. We have to look after them. We will use them sustainably. We will recognize the gift of our ancestors in transferring knowledge that allows us to know how to use them for food and medicine. And we will resist all piracy and patenting of our rich biodiversity. We will produce food and medicine in ways that everyone can be fed and everyone can have health. And we will not obey patent laws that prevent this from happening. We will not allow GM crops into our regions because they are a threat to our biodiversity and our survival. And we will make our regions toxic-free and chemical-free. Now, you know, I might talk in a certain place and this some villager will be there. And then the next time you're traveling down a remote area of Garhwal and you see on the wall, this is a GE-free, a GM-free, patent-free, chemical-free zone. And while we work to get liberation of food and life forms from the international trade treaties, I think part of what we can do everywhere is to literally work wherever we are to create that new freedom, a new inclusive freedom that includes all species, includes all people, transcending and transforming the exclusions based on gender, caste, class, religion. And that New Freedom Initiative, that New Freedom Enterprise, is something that is possible everywhere, even in the heartland of Silicon Valley. You know, Mark just mentioning he's going to appear to give evidence on the labeling issue tomorrow, and it would be wonderful to start seeing in California a movement grow of a California that is GE-free, patent-free, chemical-free. Now, once California becomes that way, can you imagine how much we'll be saved around the world? So join us in our initiatives and give us a little help. Thank you.
That was Vandana Shiva speaking on biodiversity and biopiracy. Thanks to Mariah Gallardon of TUC Radio in San Francisco for that tape.
trot in this dark heat, and robbing the rich is for worse or for best. They take it by stealing and lying and gambling, and I take it my way, my shiny black vest. I treat horses good.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us through our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.org/unwelcome. You can also download shows you may have missed or get more info on the topics covered. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.
You still catch me napping one day, and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by unwelcome travelers and other brave men. They'll take the money.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, time of useful consciousness. Arctic amplification, climate change and global warming, new challenges from the top of the world. Professor Peter Wadams. The major cause of today's sea level rise is the melting of the 2-mile-thick Greenland ice sheet. And that in turn is caused by the warming of the Arctic. The planet is now circled by satellites that measure ice thickness, temperature, methane emissions, and more. They show that the Arctic is heating up much faster than the rest of the planet. It seems counterintuitive at first, since the Arctic was recently so cold that some explorers and ships that dared go there were never seen again. None of them would have thought they needed a boat to get to the North Pole. However, today, the Arctic is no longer the refrigerator of the Earth, but instead may be the most dramatic expression of a dreaded tipping point or feedback loop in climate. Fossil fuel emissions caused the melting of the Arctic ice. Now the Arctic is accelerating global warming instead of cooling the planet because of the disappearance or thinning of the ice sheet in the Arctic summer. This ice sheet that covered the top of the world and touched the coastlines of Greenland, Canada, Alaska, and Siberia for 100,000 years has been rapidly shrinking during the Arctic summer, and that took only 30 years. and the Arctic winter is no longer cold enough to restore the ice to the former level. Professor Peter Wadhams is the UK's most experienced sea ice scientist and was director of the Scott Polar Institute in Cambridge from 1987 to 1992. He was professor of ocean physics at Cambridge from 1992 to 2015. He has made more than 50 expeditions to both polar regions. His most recent book is A Farewell to Ice. In this extraordinary, comprehensive lecture that he gave in Milano, Italy, in May 2015, Wadhams lists 7 major areas in which the Arctic determines climate change. In the previous program by TUC Radio, Wadhams explained how the Arctic sea ice is shrinking and thinning, and I encourage you to go back to the website or podcast to listen to that again for free at tucradio.org. Now you are about to hear his research results on the melting of the Greenland ice sheet. The multinational study on the recent discovery of methane releases from permafrost and shallow water, the link between sea ice loss and the extreme weather events we have already experienced, and the churning and deflections of 2 great global air and water currents, the jet stream and the thermohaline circulation. So now we are rejoining the lecture that Peter Wadhams gave in Milano, Italy. As we know, floating sea ice that melts does not affect sea level. However, melting ice on land does. Professor Peter Wadhams takes us to Greenland.
The retreat of sea ice allows warmer air to get into the Arctic, and that's having an impact on global sea levels. What we find is that in November, when the ice should be freezing up again, it's not freezing over yet. So there's still lots of open water north of Alaska and north of Siberia. It's more than 20 degrees warmer than it ought to be because there's still open water and there isn't any ice there yet. So the water is warming, and that's warming the air. The air masses in the Arctic in summer are now much warmer than they used to be. That includes the surface of the ice sheet covering Greenland. And if we look at the Greenland ice sheet, which is a huge mass of ice, 2 miles thick, it used to just get some melt on it around the edges in summer because the altitude was low, so the edges of the ice sheet would melt, the centre wouldn't. But in 2012, 97% of the ice sheet was covered with meltwater, so there was a much increased area of melt going on. So this meltwater ends up in the ocean. It melts on the surface of the Greenland ice sheet. It runs off or it runs down through the ice sheet to the bedrock and then runs out to sea. And that's increasing the amount of water in the ocean, which means it's increasing global sea levels. Up until 2007, this IPCC, this Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, was making very modest predictions about how global sea level would rise the rest of this century. But as soon as they started to see the Greenland ice sheet melting, and it's also happening a little bit in the Antarctic, that's also melting, this is the new estimate of how much sea level rise there'll be by the end of this century, and it's already up above 1 meter. And if we think about what 1 meter of sea level rise is going to do, that's a pretty massive effect all over the world. Locally, for instance, that would be enough to overwhelm the Venice gates, the flood defences in Venice. All the holiday resorts along the Adriatic would be affected. In Western Europe, Holland and Eastern England would be affected. In Europe, it's bad, but it's much worse in poorer countries like Bangladesh, where you would have very severe increase in the numbers of flood disasters. And in America, you'd have to abandon certain cities like Miami and New Orleans would just have to be abandoned. So this estimate of 1 meter of sea level rise this century is a very, very serious business. You get more and more flood disasters in the Bay of Bengal, eastern China, and these flood disasters kill hundreds of thousands of people. It's not like something in Europe that would only kill a few people. So this is a very serious effect that's coming along and is happening now, being caused mainly by the loss of ice from the Greenland ice sheet, and that's being caused mainly by the warming of the Arctic Ocean and the loss of sea ice. So the next effect in the story of doom is the loss of snow. So the snow line retreat is enhancing the albedo feedback. This area in the Northern Hemisphere is a departure from the norm. You used to, of course, have a lot of snow in everywhere, including Europe, in winter, but certainly the whole of the north of Canada and the north of Siberia would be snow-covered right through the winter into the summer. But now, if you look in June, you find areas are snow-free in June. And the decrease in area of snow in June, which is when there's most solar radiation, is now reached 6 million square kilometres compared to the average back in the 1970s. Now, 6 million square kilometres is about the area of ice that there is in the Arctic Ocean. So the retreat of the snow in early summer is as great as the retreat of the sea ice. And it has the same effect on albedo. If the snow disappears, you're left with land, you're left with forest, tundra, dark stuff, which absorbs more solar radiation. So it's exactly the same effect. It's reducing the average albedo of the planet. And so really, the Arctic is adding about a half to the direct effect of adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. So we add carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, we think we're doing something to the planet, we are, but whatever we're doing directly from the carbon dioxide content of the atmosphere, we're increasing that by 50% by the fact that that warming is causing the sea ice to retreat and it's causing the snow line to retreat. Now, another really serious threat, which we're studying at the moment with a European research program, and it's the fact that we might have a great outburst of methane coming from the seabed. When the sea ice retreats in the Arctic, it's retreating in the summer just to the centre of the Arctic. Now, the centre of the Arctic is very deep water. It's a proper ocean, 4,000 or 5,000 metres deep. But it's retreating away from the shoreline, and the coastal regions of the Arctic are actually very shallow water. This water is less than 100 metres deep. So in the Barents Sea, the Kara Sea, the Laptev Sea, the East Siberian Sea, all the seas north of Siberia, the water is very, very shallow, 50 to 100 metres water depth. And until recently, that was still covered with ice in the summer. But as soon as it retreats, you have this area which is now ice-free in summer and very shallow, so it can absorb solar radiation and the whole water mass can warm up. And we've seen that happen. This is 2007, Alaska, Siberia. The ice used to fill the whole of this area in summer, and the water warmed up to 5 degrees, more than 5 degrees centigrade. Now, that doesn't seem very warm, but it is, because it used to be down at freezing point, even in the summer. You warm it up to 5 degrees, and that warm water reaches down to the seabed and starts melting the frozen sediments on the seabed, which is called offshore permafrost. It's permafrost on land, which extends out to sea. Permafrost is where the soil is actually frozen. And so you're melting offshore permafrost by warming the offshore waters in summer because they're now ice-free. So that's an entirely new effect that didn't happen until about 10 years ago. So going up there in summer, you now find this ice-free area is releasing methane bubbles. And first of all, the methane was detected dissolved in the water, but then it started to appear actually bubbling out of the sea. This is a Russian group that's working with us, and this is what they found. The sediment at the bottom has melted, the permafrost has melted, and underneath the permafrost there's a massive amount of methane in those sediments in the form of a solid substance called methane hydrate. And the methane hydrate disintegrates when you release the pressure by melting the permafrost, and it comes out. And these are some sonar images of the methane actually coming out in plumes of methane bubbles, just hundreds of them, and forming a kind of whole curtain of methane bubbles coming up to the surface and going out into the atmosphere, which is increasing global warming. And each year that they go out there, there's more of this. There's more methane bubbles. There's more a bigger area where this is happening. So what's it doing to the planet? Well, at the moment, methane levels in the global atmosphere have started to rise again. They seem to have reached a kind of flat limit. Nobody quite knew why they'd stopped rising, but they did stop rising in about the year 2000, and we had nearly a decade of steady methane levels. Two German methane measuring stations showed levels starting to rise again about 2008. And these are methane levels measured throughout the atmosphere by a couple of satellites that can sense the level of methane in the atmosphere. And there's a lot more methane in the Arctic atmosphere in the later satellite pictures than the earlier ones. So it does look as if the methane that's coming up offshore off Siberia is actually contributing to a methane increase globally. Methane, of course, spreads all around the atmosphere very fast, so it's hard to tell where it comes from. This is a global map of methane from a satellite, and we can see there's more methane in the northern hemisphere than the southern hemisphere. The levels are about 10% higher in the northern hemisphere, and it suggests that there's an increased and enhanced source of methane somewhere in the northern hemisphere, and so we think that might be the Arctic. In Cambridge, we modelled what would happen if all the methane that's trapped in these sediments came out very quickly. That may not happen. That would be a worst case, would be that the permafrost melted so fast that all the methane trapped in it was released quickly. But if it were, then it would cause an increase in global warming by about 0.6 of a degree, which means we're doubling the amount of warming that the Earth has received just within a few years. So it would be a real disaster. You know, it's like going into debt and then taking on even more debt. You just don't want to do that. So we think that the threat of a methane outbreak will be to make global warming worse very quickly. And so we hope it doesn't happen, of course. And then we estimated what the costs of this would be. We're working with an economist who works with the model that's used in the Stern Review of Climate Change, and he estimated it's going to cost the world $60 trillion over 100 years. But, you know, you can't believe anything that economists say, but it will cost a lot anyway. The figure is very, very high. And most recent work, this is work done this last summer, has shown that this source of methane is over a bigger area than we thought, that the Norwegians have gone into the western part of the Arctic, the Kara Sea, and found methane plumes there. And the Swedes worked in the Laptev Sea, that's halfway round, and found methane plumes in the Laptev Sea. And in fact, they described them as an Arctic methane megaflare. So instead of just the East Siberian Sea, we're seeing these methane emissions all around the shallow waters of the Arctic, the East Siberian Sea, the Laptev Sea, and the Kara Sea. So the area is bigger than we thought. So we really have to worry about that. And longer term, you have to worry about methane emitted from permafrost on land, because the permafrost on land is also melting, but more slowly, and that's releasing methane. So over a long period, you'll get increased methane emissions from all the tundra which has permafrost at the moment. And we've seen rises in temperature of permafrost wherever we look. So methane is a real threat, and it's an immediate threat. We have to keep going up there every year to see how much the methane plumes are increasing. Finally, in the tale of woe, there's the problem of food. What seems to be happening is there's a link between the retreat of sea ice and extreme weather events. And this is, the newspapers have been full of this sort of thing, that we've been getting weird winter weather in Europe and North America, and it's associated with the retreat of sea ice. The reason is that, you're warming the Arctic, and that's changing the position of the jet stream. The jet stream is the boundary between Arctic air masses and lower latitude air masses, and it has big loops in it. If the Arctic's warming up, which it is, and the tropics are not warming up so fast, then the temperature difference between the Arctic and the tropics is decreasing. So the Earth is losing part of this temperature gradient between the Arctic and the tropics, and that's causing winds to slow down. So as the jet stream slows down, it adopts bigger loops because it's not moving so fast. And the bigger loops mean that Arctic air can come down into North America, can come down into Europe, while tropical air can move up into places that it never used to be, the Midwest of America and other parts of the world. So the bigger loops on the jet stream mean that some parts of the world get more extreme cold weather in winter and other parts get more extreme warm weather. So the parts that get more extreme cold weather, say, the people there say, well, global warming isn't happening because we're getting colder weather. But in fact, as a whole, the planet's getting warmer weather, but it's just distributed in a new way. And the trouble is, those big loops that are changing the masses of air that different countries are getting, unfortunately, they interact with all the best crop-producing areas of the world. So these are the areas of croplands which have the highest productivity, and we can see it's a mid-latitude range through North America, Europe, into Russia. There's a lot of crops there which are affected by the jet stream, which is looping along up here, changing its pattern, and those crops are threatened. Not only do we get serious impacts from the ice retreat causing these jet stream to change, but in the long run, we'll get a reduction in production from crops just because of warming. And one of the reasons why politicians say we mustn't let temperatures rise beyond 2 degrees is that as soon as you get more warming, up to 3 or 4 degrees, the productivity of the major food crops in the world goes down. Some of them go up because you're getting more CO2 encourages growth. So for a little while, we actually get more food production from rice and wheat. But once it gets warmer than that, it goes down rapidly. And 4 degrees is what at the moment is predicted for the end of the century. So by the end of the century, we'll have several tens of percent less production of the main food crops. And that's at a time when the global population is increasing very fast. So the collision between global population increase and global food production decrease once you get beyond 2 degrees is a very serious one. I mean, it's one where a lot of people will starve, billions of people will starve. So it's very, very serious that we should not allow global temperatures to rise beyond 2 degrees. It's not just an arbitrary figure pulled out of thin air. It is the figure that determines whether crop production goes up or goes down. So already we're getting global drought occurring more frequently than in the past, and the price of food is already going up. The final, a happy note, our warming is being reduced by an effect which is also due to sea ice retreating. There's a very slow circulation in the world ocean called the thermohaline circulation. It's not related to winds, it's related to temperatures and evaporation. And it's got a section in the northern Atlantic which is bringing heat in the Gulf Stream up from the tropical Atlantic to Europe, making us warmer than we would otherwise be. So we're about 5 to 10 degrees warmer than we ought to be. And part of what drove that circulation was that water coming up to the high latitudes sank down to the seabed in a place in the middle of the Greenland Sea called the Odden Ice Tongue. And that was due to the ice cover in the Greenland Sea, the Arctic ice cover, coming down the east coast of Greenland, turning around and forming an area of, because of currents, forming an area of cold water where ice was forming. And as the ice formed, salt that was in the ocean didn't get incorporated into the ice, but just went back into the ocean, increased the salinity of the ocean. The ocean got more, water got more dense, and it sank. And it sank in a really interesting way, which we were studying until we ran out of research funds, called chimneys, which were the surface water was sinking down to 2,500 meters of the ocean down towards the seabed in the form of a kind of cylinder, rotating cylinder of sinking water. And you were getting those in this area called the Odden in the middle of the Greenland Sea. And we were studying that and finding this was what was driving this thermohaline circulation. But then suddenly the Odden stopped being there because of global warming. The Odden ice tongue doesn't form anymore. And so the chimneys are not forming. And the result, according to modellers, is going to be this. By the end of the century, the warming of most of continental Europe, including Italy, will be about 4 degrees, and that's going to be disastrous for crops and a lot of things with life are going to be much harder. It's going to be a bit like North Africa. So most of continental Europe is going to warm by about 4 degrees by the end of the century. But this effect on the thermohaline circulation of the chimneys not forming anymore will keep the Atlantic cooler, and that will limit the warming for countries like Britain, Iceland, Western France, Holland, Norway, and they will only get about 2 to 3 degrees. So it's still quite serious, but of course the price is that the tropical ocean will warm more rapidly, so you have a lot more and worse hurricanes in the south. So there we are. It's mainly a very bad story. And what's happening is that global warming driven by CO2 is doing all these things to the planet. The Arctic is making things worse because the Arctic amplification of warming means that Arctic sea ice is retreating faster. And then all that open water that used to be ice covered is having all these impacts on global sea level rise, on global albedo, and on methane emissions. It's the villain is us by putting carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, but the impact is done via the Arctic. The Arctic's getting the most warming, and then it's doing all these other things to the planet. So what do we do? And of course, we should be stopping emitting carbon dioxide, but there's no sign that people are going to do that. And these are things that might put a kind of sticking plaster on global warming for a while. And it's techniques called geoengineering, which have been proposed, but we don't know if they'll work. And they consist of either going up into the upper atmosphere and deliberately putting powder into the stratosphere to reflect solar radiation. So you have to keep flying up there with high-flying aircraft, releasing this powdered material into the upper atmosphere. Or there's another method that's been proposed of called cloud brightening, where you take the grey, miserable clouds that are typical of Britain, for instance, and you spray very fine water vapour into them through vertical columns, and that whitens them and increases their albedo to offset global warming. So there are technical methods that would slow down global warming, but in the long run, we have to stop emitting carbon dioxide, which means changing the way we live. And the question is, can we do that fast enough? Can we get geoengineering methods that will work quickly enough to offset global warming before we get to some catastrophic level? That's the challenge that we face, which is partly coming from the Arctic. And so that's why the Arctic is important.
That was part two of a one-hour talk by Professor Peter Wadams on Arctic amplification, climate change, global warming, new challenges from the top of the world. He spoke in Milano, Italy, on May 29, 2015. Peter Wadhams is the UK's most experienced sea ice scientist. He has made more than 50 expeditions to both polar regions, working from ice camps, icebreakers, and aircraft. He made 6 submerged voyages to the North Pole on Royal Navy submarines. Wadhams' research group in Cambridge has been the only UK group with the capacity to carry out field work on sea ice. Come to TUC Radio's website for more information. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio's free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Time of useful consciousness is an aeronautical term. It's the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time to rescue the planet and the plane. My name is Maria Gelaudin. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Where chickens thrive, humans are nearby. Portable and good travelers, chickens have been carried around the world by humans. Currently, there are 3 chickens alive at any one time for each individual person alive on Earth. Descendants of dinosaurs, chickens are primarily cared for by women. They're a never-ending source of slang and continue to be depicted in religious and/or political symbols around the world. Americans eat, on average, 80 pounds of chicken per year, 4 times the world average, yet chickens raised for food are not considered animals under the United States laws and generally not subject to humane treatment regulations. Our guest in this edition of Radio Curious is Andrew Lawler, author of Why Did the Chicken Cross the World? The Epic Saga of the Bird That Powers Civilization. Andrew Lawler and I visited by phone from his home in the North Carolina hills on March 27, 2015, and began our conversation when I asked him how far back the lineage of the chicken goes in the world.
Well, if you want to take it way back, there was a recent study that was done based on a Tyrannosaurus rex bone that was found in Montana a few years ago. And when they did the analysis of a little piece of cartilage that was discovered, they found a protein, and that protein was identical to a protein that is found in today's chicken. So that was really definitive proof, the first genetic proof that, in fact, the chicken and other birds are descended directly from dinosaurs.
When we eat a chicken, it's a relative of a dinosaur.
If you look closely at a chicken, if you look at its feet, and particularly if you were ever to attend a cockfight, though they're illegal, they happen in many parts of the world, you would see the ferocity that still exists, particularly within roosters.
Let's move forward as to when chickens were domesticated and became close in proximity to people.
Well, this is a rather hot topic because we don't actually have clear answers yet. Unlike a lot of other animals, like the dog, like the cat, we know very little about the early history of the chicken. Partly that's because its bones don't survive very well. They're smaller, and also people tended to eat them. And as well as dogs and other animals in a barnyard would devour what was left of any chicken. But there are some really good ideas that have come out of recent genetic studies as well as archaeological work. And it seems that the chicken was first domesticated probably in Southeast Asia and probably many thousands of years ago, say 5,000 or 6,000 years ago. Now, why it was domesticated for me was the big surprise. I assumed, like most people probably would, that the chicken was domesticated to eat either its flesh or its eggs. But in fact, a lot of archaeologists now believe that the chicken was first domesticated, in fact, for its fighting abilities. I mentioned cockfighting. That cockfighting may have been the original use of the chicken by early people in Southeast Asia.
For entertainment?
Probably not. Probably it began as a religious ritual. There are still many countries, many places, such as Bali in the country of Indonesia, where cockfights are still associated with religious ritual, where you want to shed blood before you begin a fight, before you begin a religious ritual. So you have a chicken fight, and they shed blood on the ground, and that paves the way for a religious ritual to take place. So it may sound a little crazy to modern-day folks in the West, but the chicken has long been associated with religious rituals, and it seems that perhaps these cockfights began as religious rituals that then, like bullfighting, say in Spain, turned into entertainment.
Religious rituals with chickens still exist in the United States and in many other countries. Tell us about them.
Oh, absolutely. Probably the most famous example is within Santeria. And Santeria is an Afro-Caribbean tradition that combines West African religions with Christianity, brought from West Africa by slaves and then adapted to the New World. And the West Africans were very familiar with chicken, and the chicken was a basic part of their rituals. It was easy to sacrifice. It was small. It wasn't like sacrificing a cow. Most people could afford to sacrifice a chicken. And so they're still used commonly in Santeria rituals as a way to propitiate the deities in that faith. And it's not just African traditions. The Jewish tradition still uses the chicken. There is a ritual that takes place in parts of New York, for example. I went to Crown Heights in New York on the eve of Yom Kippur, and there some Orthodox Jews, they swing a chicken over their heads as a way of taking away their sins for the new year. So they enter the new year clean, and these chickens are then butchered and given to the poor to eat. So here there are two very diverse traditions, obviously, but I think it points out how versatile the chicken has been in human religions over the past millennia.
Let's go back several millennia, Andrew Lawler, and tell us how the chickens have spread in the past 4,000 years throughout the world.
Well, the first real evidence we have for domesticated chickens come from today's Pakistan and Western India. This was an area that was part of the Indus River civilization. It's not as well known as Egypt or Mesopotamia, that is today's Iraq, but about 4,000 years ago, there were three great civilizations, Egypt, Mesopotamia, and the Indus River Valley. China was just beginning to blossom then. And archaeologists have found evidence of domesticated chickens in the Indus River Valley. Now, what seems very likely based on textual evidence found in Mesopotamia is that the chicken made its way from India by boat to Arabia and up the Persian Gulf to the great city of Ur, which is famous for traditionally being the home of Abraham in the Bible, who left Ur. Ur in 2000 BC was the big city of its day. It was the London, New York, Shanghai of its day, a very cosmopolitan place where traders from all over the world, the known world at that time, came to trade and to mix and mingle. And with this trade came the chicken. And from there, the bird seems to have spread to Egypt maybe 500 years or so later. But what's interesting is that during these early years in the West, the chicken was actually a royal bird. It was so exotic that it was kept in the zoos of kings. Thutmose, for example, in Egypt, the pharaoh, he kept the bird, as well as Mesopotamian rulers at the same time. So there were very few chickens, and they were very exotic looking, and they weren't common, and they weren't used for eating or for their eggs. They were clearly prized because they were beautiful and somewhat regal.
Eventually, chickens were brought to all of the continents except Antarctica.
So the chicken began to spread from Southeast Asia up into China, and then it worked its way west to India, as I mentioned, and then to Europe. And eventually it made its way to the New World. Now, how it got to the New World is a really interesting question. Most people had long assumed that since there were no chickens, chickens are native to the New World, that Columbus brought them. And in fact, Columbus did take chickens with him. But about 10 years ago, an archaeologist in Chile discovered some chicken bones on the coast of Chile in South America. And when those bones were dated, they seemed to be pre-Columbian. That is, they seemed to have been part of a chicken that lived before 1492. Now, this was a shocker because if the chicken did not exist in the New World until Columbus brought it, how could you have a chicken predating 1492? Well, there's been a big debate about whether or not the dating on those bones is correct, but the authors of that research paper postulated that the chicken actually arrived in the New World from the other direction, that it came from Polynesia. And today we do know that the chicken was essential for the settlement of the Pacific Islands by the Polynesians. And that wherever they went, they tended to take dogs and pigs and chickens. But the one animal that they never did without, including on Easter Island, which was the most far-flung place that we know they arrived, they had the chicken. And in fact, Easter Islanders seem to have survived in part because they had chickens. They had these enormous stone chicken coops. And it's very possible that those Polynesians traveled a little bit further, 1,000 miles or so further, to the east and hit South America, in which case the chicken may actually have been introduced from the other direction.
Let's talk about chickens in the United States and their development in our country. But before you answer that, I'd like to say that we're visiting with Andrew Lawler. He's the author of Why Did the Chicken Cross the World? The Epic Saga of the Bird That Powers Civilization. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. The United States and chickens, what's the development?
Well, the chicken came with the first Westerners, the first Europeans that arrived in the United States in 1607, the first permanent settlement in Jamestown, and the chickens there helped the colonists survive harsh few winters. And also in the Plymouth colony to the north, that was settled a dozen years or so later, the chicken was also an important part of the original livestock that were brought over. But very quickly, the bird became, played second fiddle to all the other animals that were available. There were geese, there were ducks, and of course there was the turkey, which served in a similar role as the chicken in the New World. So there was a lot of competition, and the chicken was not really considered very important. Now, as a result of that, when slaves were living on plantations across the southern part of the United States, their masters tended to think of chickens as unimportant. Therefore, they allowed slaves, who mostly were from West Africa, where the chicken was widely used and people had great experience in caring for chickens, they were allowed to actually have chickens and to sell them to their owners. So it was one of the very few ways that African Americans were allowed to express the entrepreneurial spirit. And over time, from the 1600s up until the Civil War, the African Americans were known as the general chicken merchants throughout the South. And both freed slaves and as well as both those who were freed and those who were still enslaved on plantations took part in this economy. And a lot of slaves earned a fair amount of money and were able to actually build up some cash, which was extremely unusual then. It was about the only way that slaves could do so. So the chicken actually became a really important part of the plantation economy and a way for African Americans to make some money.
In your book, Why Did the Chicken Cross the World?, you have a section devoted to the fact that women were the ones who primarily looked after and cared for the chickens. Tell us about that.
Yes, this was a little bit of a surprise when I began to dig into it because, you know, again, the chicken was considered not so important. And men who were farming 100 years or so ago, they thought of themselves as real farmers who farmed cotton or tobacco or corn or other crops. If they had a lot of animal husbandry, it was pigs or cattle. Chickens were considered women's work. Those are the animals that lived outside the back door and would get the scraps from the meals. They weren't considered very important economically. They were just a nice addition to the farmyard, but were not critical for making everything run. But women knew better. They understood that the chicken actually was extremely useful, not only providing eggs and recycling the scraps, but also in the meat that ultimately resulted when a chicken was too old to lay eggs or to crow people awake in the morning. So gradually women began to use chickens as the cities developed, particularly in the north, to make money, much as African Americans had done previously. So by the late 1800s, there were a lot of women who were able to get a good deal of money by selling eggs and having them shipped in the new railroads that had been built to the cities of the north. And this really gave women an income that many had not had before, where men generally controlled the family finances. So it provided a really important source of revenue for women, particularly in the South, where the farmers tended to be, you know, quite poor. So it really became a way for women to have enough money to go to town, to buy a dress, to become more educated, and served an important role in our society during the 19th century.
On the flyleaf of your book, you point out that at any given time in the world, there are three chickens for every person. In other words, over 20 billion chickens are on the earth right now, notwithstanding the fact that they don't sleep by our feet like dogs and cats. So relate that, if you would, to the food value of the chicken meat and the eggs that they give us.
Well, the chicken has come a long way. As we talked about in the past, the bird was used for a variety of purposes. It woke the farmer up. It provided a source of a religious ritual. It provided entertainment through cockfighting. It had a lot of roles. It also could tell the future, according to some societies, such as the ancient Romans. But when we get to the present day, the chicken is seen almost strictly as an economic production machine. It is a meat and egg machine. So when the chicken became the meat and egg machine for the world, suddenly the numbers of chickens shot up. So starting in the 1920s and 1930s, the number of chickens that were grown both for their meat and their eggs began to increase exponentially. And you can track the urbanization in the developed world and now in the developing world, and it tracks very clearly with the growth of chickens. In other words, the more cities, the more people in cities, the more chickens. And those chickens, of course, are not, for the most part, in people's backyards anymore. They're in huge cities of their own, these kind of gulags almost, chicken gulags that exist usually far away from cities, but which are producing billions and billions of chickens a year for consumption, as well as billions and billions of eggs.
Andrew Lawler, notwithstanding the fact of the industrial production of chickens, a rather morbid topic and something that we might not want to know about, we can perhaps devote another program to, tell us about a visit you had with a woman who wore a pin that said, "Stick up for chickens." This woman is a vegan.
Yes, that's right. Karen Davis, who lives on the eastern shore of Virginia, has a farm, and there she cares for rescue chickens. That is, chickens that, say, have fallen off a truck going to a processing factory, or somebody has rescued it from a research lab. And I decided to visit her because, you know, there's a lot that's been written about the treatment of chickens, and I wanted to meet somebody who actually feels strongly about chickens as animals that are due a good deal of respect. And when I went to visit, she took me on a tour, and I was able to see, I think, more clearly the individuality of chickens, as well as the kind of the other side, the dark side of the way we have bred chickens. So chickens today, industrial chickens, often have been bred so that they have enormous breasts, sometimes breasts that are so heavy that their legs actually break. But in other words, we've designed them to be meat machines and perhaps have forgotten that actually they are living creatures that suffer. So Karen Davis is an example of somebody who is really trying to hold a mirror up to us and show us that the chicken deserves better, that these are creatures that, like dogs or cats, people would be appalled if a dog or a cat were treated that way. The chickens are no different. You know, these are creatures that have a good deal of intelligence, and we know that from recent research. I went to a lab in Italy where they're doing a good deal of chicken research, and they really have shown quite clearly that the bird has a good deal of intelligence, has memory. It can count. Small chicks that are just hatched can perform logical problems successfully. So when you put it all together, I think it's time for us to reevaluate how we treat chickens and what these birds actually are. Because under U.S. law, I was amazed to find out, the chicken is not even considered an animal. In other words, there are no protections in place for chickens whatsoever because they're considered meat. They're not considered animals.
So staying with how chickens are treated, let's look at the genetic changes that are being established to create chickens that are easy to care for, inexpensive, and adaptable. Using the example that you tell us in your book, Why Did the Chicken Cross the World?, about a woman in Kenya named Sheila Ame.
Yes, I went to visit Sheila in Nairobi. She's an agronomist at a university there, and she's given a lot of thought to how to adapt chickens to particular environments. In Kenya, for example, they have very extreme weather. It gets very hot there. There are lots of different diseases, and Western chickens simply don't do well there. A lot of well-meaning NGOs have brought chickens to Kenya and tried to raise them there, and they have tended to die off. So Sheila's been trying to promote the use of village chickens, to adapt village chickens for wider use across Kenya. And it's really important because often the eggs that these chickens produce are important sources of protein, particularly for children. And the meat, of course, is often really critical during certain seasons where the harvest is not in or the harvest has been destroyed. So the work that she's doing, I think, is great because it shows that the existing village chickens around the world, which have been pretty much ignored by geneticists working in the poultry industry, are actually quite valuable for millions and perhaps billions of people around the world.
So in the Reproduction Act of Chickens, you point out that the rooster has no penis. How are the hen's ovum fertilized?
Well, that's a good question. It's quite hilarious that the bird that is considered the epitome of the male organ actually does not have a penis, as you mentioned. What chickens do when they do it is they do what's delicately called a cloacal kiss. That is, these birds have a cloaca. That is one exit for everything, for the egg, for the sperm, and for waste. And when they press their cloacas together, the rooster's sperm is injected into the hen's cloaca and then can fertilize the eggs that are being produced in her ovum. So it's a pretty remarkable system that has evolved for chickens that is fairly unique. There are other animals like ducks, for example, where the males do have penises, But in the case of chickens and a few other birds, they have evolved away from having penises and have simply found another way. And a way, I might add, that clearly is, has proved to be an evolutionary success.
Can you relate the development of slang to chicken and chicken parts?
Absolutely. There's so many words that we use that are related to chicken that we might even we might not even realize. The most famous, of course, is cockpit. Our pilots steer their planes from the cockpit. Now, the cockpit, of course, is the place where cockfighting took place. There are lots of other examples that involve fighting. But what's interesting is that the ideas of being chicken, that is, being a coward, these are pretty new ideas, and they came about in the early 20th century. This is the time when the chicken was becoming industrialized, where thousands and thousands and thousands of chickens were being crammed together into chicken houses, and people began to think of chickens as kind of dumb, which was not the case in the ancient world, where chickens actually were considered to be very in tune with spirits, with understanding what's going to happen in the future. They were considered close to the gods. But that began to change in the early 20th century, and our whole idea of chicken now, I think, says more about us than it does about the chicken, because it happened when we began to mass produce the bird.
You close your book with an interesting story about the return of the red jungle fowl to its origin.
Yes, one of the sad results of the chicken spreading around the world is that the chicken is mating with the very wild bird that it came from, the bird called the red jungle fowl that lives in South Asia. So as chickens have spread across South Asia and into small villages, the villages are more and more taking over the forest areas, and the red jungle fowl's habitat now is shared with domesticated chickens. And as a result, because domesticated chickens can breed with the red jungle fowl, the red jungle fowl is losing its genetic integrity. And this is of some concern, because you want to be able to maintain a wild creature, partly because it has a great deal of genetics that would be lost if we only had domesticated birds, and partly simply because it's probably a good thing to be able to keep a wild creature in its wild state. So there are some biologists here in the United States who have been working to find purebred red jungle fowl in order to reseed the forests of South Asia with these birds. And I think it's a wonderful endeavor, because I think it forces people to confront the fact that the chicken is extremely important for our society, and that the wild bird ought to be respected as well as the domesticated creature.
Well, Andrew Lawler, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious. And before we close, can you share with us a eureka or an aha moment in your life that changed your view of the world?
Well, my aha moment was, it took place in the middle of the night. I had been working on a book idea about how civilization spread across the world, and I was trying to find a way to express it. I had just done an article for Smithsonian Magazine about the chicken, and I woke up in the middle of the night and thought, that's it. Why did the chicken cross the world? That actually, by following the chicken and by tracing its movement, we're able to better understand the spread of civilization, and more importantly, something about humanity. And I love this idea that the chicken is a mirror for us, that it's not just a creature that we might eat, but it actually has so much information that can tell us so much about ourselves.
And Andrew Lawler, what would you like to do with the rest of your one precious life?
Well, I want to write more books. So right now I'm currently working on some freelance articles. I just got back from the Amazon doing a story about uncontacted people in the jungles there. And I'm exploring different ideas that I might pursue. But I love writing, I love exploring, I love traveling, and I hope to do that as long as I can.
And finally, is there a book that you could recommend to our listeners?
Yes, absolutely. There's a number that I would highly praise. I think one that readers maybe are very familiar with that I found really enjoyable is Guns, Germs, and Steel by Jared Diamond, which gives a very nice big picture view of how civilization spread. And then there are about 10,000 novels I could name, but I'll just leave it at one.
Well, Andrew Lawler, author of Why Did the Chicken Cross the World? Thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
It's been a pleasure, Barry. Thank you.
Andrew Lawler is the author of Why Did the Chicken Cross the World? The Epic Saga of the Bird That Powers Civilization. The book Andrew Lawler recommends is Guns, Germs, and Steel, The Fates of Human Societies by Jared M. Diamond. This program was recorded on March 27, 2015. There are over 750 archives on our website, radiocurious.org, and I'm honored to tell you that Radio Curious is now part of the collection at the Library of Congress. We appreciate your cards, ideas, and letters, and do enjoy hearing from you. The email is curious@radiocurious.org. The postal address is 700 West Smith Street, Ukiah, California, 95482. The phone is 707-621-5075. Ignacio Ayala is the assistant producer. I'm host and producer, Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.